Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. Coming to you live from east of Charlotte, North Carolina.
The spice.
This is where the past meets the future, and tonight's program will be right on target with that theme. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear, you'll be safely traveling with us. Whether you're driving across the country tonight or working on your favorite project, listening to an archive, I promise you're going to be informed by tonight's program. Lots going on, and lots has gone on in history, and that's why we bring it to you from a little different perspective. By the way, the solar wind is an absolutely scorching 738 kilometers per second with four sunspot clusters on the sun today. The NOAA forecasters estimate a 50% chance of polar geomagnetic storms today as this high-speed solar wind stream buffets Earth's magnetic field. Now, the warning comes on the heels of a lengthy G2-class geomagnetic storm on May 31st. June 1st sparked by the arrival of an interplanetary shockwave. That's what they're calling it. Now, the source of the shockwave is really unknown. Remember, we are firmly in the galactic plane right now, and we are exposed to the multi-light speed effects of waves that are generated from the galaxy center. These waves induce resonations in the crust that can excite earthquakes, volcanoes, and even sudden shifts in weather due to strain placed on the upper atmosphere. Cosmic rays can sputter fluorescing rays that often result in very high altitude haze, which can block the IR from the sun from reaching the ground. This is affectionately called global cooling. Now, the current solar press corps speculation focuses on a co-rotating interaction region that's known as a CIR. That is a shock-like transition zone between high and low-speed solar wind streams. We see similar atmospheric activity here on Earth, but remember, it is speculation. Our theory that we are experiencing extrasolar forces is just a sound. Whatever it was, the impact ignited some beautiful auroras. Some of them have been seen as far south as Nebraska. Also, we know that Friday, massive asteroid 1998 QE2 and its moon, yes, it was dense enough to have its own moon revolving around it, flew past Earth on May 31st, a mere 5.1 million kilometers away. Nice and safe. But one of the things it did do is it kind of alerted us to the fact that, hey, maybe we're not ready for this. Trust me. The government has everything in control, under control. There is a committee that meets once a year in Pasadena, California. And now they have a small budget to start thinking about putting a committee together to think about putting a plan together to divert an asteroid away from a collision with Earth. Don't look for anything anytime soon. Not a good place to apply for a job, I would say. Now, tonight on X Squared Radio, we have a treat. You know, this is where the past meets the future, and we often like to have experts in investigative reporting on the past on the program. And that is the case tonight. We have Diana West. She is the author of a book called American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. It's put out by St. Martin's Press. Here's what's said. Diana West masterfully reminds us of what history is for, to suggest action for the present. She paints for us the broad picture of our own long record of failing to recognize bullies and villains. She shows how American denial today reflects a pattern that held strongly in period of the Soviet Union. She is the Michelangelo of denial. That said, the story of Betrayal, this fantastic book that she has written, lays out a de facto communist occupation of Washington by American traitors loyal to Stalin. Now, that's not a name that we hear very often in current events. But when I was young, that was a name that was bandied about, and people have no idea how powerful he was, or those that that followed him and took his orders. But in the 1930s under FDR, it would result in policies and procedures and actions by those inside our government. I was going to say by our government, but that might not be accurate. And those actions and policies were covered up by successive U.S. administrations and elites. And what Diana West has succeeded in doing is finding the truth tellers. American Betrayal presents a rewrite of most of World War II and Cold War history, something she never imagined doing when she first began writing the book. This is simply the story that took shape from her research. And that's what often happens when we undertake a book project. It takes the shape in the book in a first-person narrative, exactly as she stumbled across the revelations and put them together according to two basic mechanisms. Now, she's going to come on the program tonight. We're going to have a discussion. She is a wonderful speaker in her own right. And that's what's wonderful about the format we have here on X Squared Radio. The BBS Radio Network gives us 3 hours each week. And I do not break up the program into a bunch of commercial breaks. What we do is we try to do 55 to 60 minutes straight with no interruptions. And that way, the guest and me can make our full point without interrupting you and taking you away from the content. You can stay with it, put it on your iPad, listen to it while you're driving, and you don't have to listen to some old commercial while you're driving. That's not why people buy archives to X Squared Radio and to BBSRadio.com. We have been on the BBS Radio Network now for 8 years, and we like to think of ourselves in the top 3 or 4 programs on this network. BBS Radio is factually the largest webcast radio network on the planet. A lot more content, a lot more hours of straight content, 7 days a week right here on this network than any other webcast network. A lot of it is current. Some of it is archive. This program is live Sunday nights from 8 to 11 Eastern time. And it is a call-in program. So I'm going to give out the phone numbers now. And in about 5 minutes, we're going to bring Diana West, author of the book American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character, on the program. The phone number toll-free anywhere in North America, 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. I promise you, you're going to have some questions about the history that is presented here tonight. The facts that are being revealed tonight are not only going to change the way you understand history, but they might change, hopefully will change, the way you think about the integrity, the faith and credit of not only the United States of America, but other nations as well. Anywhere else outside of North America, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can reach us, 530-413-9537. 530-413-9537. And if you're outside the country, we have a lot of listeners in New Zealand. Many of them write me during the week. It's actually afternoon there now. You guys can reach us by getting us at BBS Radio on Skype. I think there's also another address. Is it BBS Radio 2? Let me see if I can get the station to write me really quick. And feel free to call in on Skype, so it'll be toll-free for you guys as well. Yeah, BBS Radio and the number 2 if you want to Skype in from New Zealand live. Some of you are interested in American politics, American history, but this is really global history because we're going to cover a period in World War II that covers 24 years of American presidencies. That would be 2, Roosevelt and Eisenhower. And it also sets the stage for the way politics and presidential policies are going today. So those are the ways to get a hold of us tonight. Write your questions down and give us a call, and we'll discuss them. My guest in just about 3 minutes is going to be Diana West. Now, one of the things that we find when we go into history, and I think you already know this to be true, is that the victors get to write the history. The people that were defeated never get their story told. But in this case, it is perhaps maybe the American people that were obfuscated by our own government. And so I would rather not say that it is the victors that wrote the history, because that would mean that the American people lost. And maybe now, after 80 years from the beginning of this debacle, maybe we're finally coming around to the victory cycle. Let's go ahead and bring Diana. Diana West, welcome to X Squared Radio. How are you?
I'm just fine, thanks. How are you, Brooks?
I'm fantastic. I was privileged to see your interview on C-SPAN on Book TV, and I was just fascinated by it. Of course, we love history on this program, and what we really like to do is to investigate history and find out if we were really told the whole story or not. And I was just amazed at the things that you had discovered in your book, and I couldn't wait to get you on the program to discuss them.
Thank you.
Now,
it is a shocking story.
Well, it is, and I've written a few books myself, and most. Some of the people that listen to this program have. And one of the things we do is we make a book outline and we say, okay, I'm going to go interview this person and, you know, go to this building and file this under the Freedom of Information Act and see what I get. But the discoveries along the way sometimes shock us or bring us to tears or even change the direction of what we're going to write about. So
yes.
What happened to you when you set about writing this book? Did you already have the title in mind or did you just took off?
That is a great question. No, the original book that I was going to write when I started in 2009 was called The Hollow Center. Very different feel than American Betrayal. But over the next couple of years, really 2-3 years of very hard research, I realized that the center that I was thinking of that I had in this sort of poetic notion was not hollow at all, and that there was something in it, and indeed I increasingly felt personally betrayed by the history I was discovering, not by the American people, as you point out in your introduction, but by our leaders. And what I realized was that this story had never been told, which is kind of a strange thing, particularly when you're going back over something having to do with World War II, which just that we can hardly count the books and documentaries and movies devoted to that epic struggle. However, what I discovered, and this is really where the kind of eureka moment starts coming, is that the intelligence history, namely the history brought out literally from the archives in the Soviet Union and in Washington that opened after the dissolution of the Soviet Union in 1991, this history had never been integrated into our general understanding in history. In other words, the American treason that those archives show, documented, names and dates, had never been incorporated into our understanding of what was going on the surface. And so, essentially, I took the two templates and laid them on top of one another, and that was the story of this betrayal that I write about.
Well, one of the things that, fascinated me, and I must confess I haven't read the book, although I've tried to get my hands on as much as I can about it. It just came out. I mean, it just went live
just
on Amazon.
Days ago. Mm-hmm.
So, and it's got to be taking off in the charts because this is of utmost curiosity. In my mind, there are four different areas of concentration I think we can cover in a three-hour program if you want to stay the whole 3 hours. One is,
I'm happy.
That, you know, the question is, how did we get in this position? I mean, how in the world could this betrayal take place if we had an administration, at least a few layers deep, of ultra-patriots that were concerned with saving the world? How do we get
saving
in this position?
Saving the world or saving America? I think there's a difference. And
well,
I think that,
you know,
that
at the time,
though,
but it could be argued at the time that America really wasn't threatened. It was Europe. I mean, it was over there. We weren't drawn into that war in Europe until 1941, and that was just, you know, a relationship of allies, and we used, you know, a U-boat attack on a steamship as an excuse to get into the war. So America was really not being threatened.
Mm-hmm. That's true. However, the first attack, of course, famously, that brought us into the conflict in an official way, of course, was the December 7th attack, 1941 attack on Pearl Harbor. Now, thus began the war in the Pacific, and indeed on December 8th, 1941, our troops, our army in the Philippines, along with Philippine Army, under MacArthur, was attacked by the Japanese. December 7th is the day that lives in infamy. December 8th, we don't really know that much about. And I'll tell you, one of my first aha moments was as I was looking into the decision-making process, that even as we had 150,000 troops, American and Filipino troops in the Philippines, besieged, going through the utmost deprivation, attacks, killing, wounding, no supplies, just being utterly destroyed by the Japanese at this stage of the war, why was Washington still focused on Europe? Why was there no relief effort sent to the Pacific? Now, this seems like an elementary question, and yet it had never come to me. And I actually read something that so brought me up short. It was some words of an intelligence officer under MacArthur, a man named Colonel Warren Clear. And it was not until 1962 that his words were published. But he said meaning the men on the Philippines, they were the only Americans in the world at this time who were fighting the enemy, yet the flood of weapons from their country's arsenals was being rushed to every other battlefront but theirs. Now, this is not the way we commonly think of the beginning of the war, and yet this was what was going on. And indeed, when the British came to parley with Roosevelt in December 1941, the very first wartime conference with Churchill and Roosevelt, it's called Arcadia, it lasted weeks, the British were fully prepared for the Americans to reverse their priorities and say, you know what, we've got an army in the Philippines under siege, so we're going to have to take care of the Japanese first and, you know, continue to help you and so on, but, you know, we've got to go save our people. This didn't happen. And this is one of the questions that I just started trying to go back through the layers of the narrative as we know it to try to understand why. And I was deeply shocked by what I found out.
And what did you find out? Why did we leave the Japanese front alone and literally let them take island after island and literally dominate the Pacific with their fleets? And by the way, they had far superior aircraft to ours. The Zero could fly circles around a P-40. There were a lot of reasons why the Japanese were able to occupy as much as they could, because they were really superior at what they were doing.
Well, I think the best way to answer that is to try to understand that our policymaking machinery had already, by that point, been infiltrated by scores of agents, American agents, loyal to the Soviet Union. And this deeply affected our policymaking to a point where really the best way to describe the American war strategy at this point, and indeed throughout the war, was Soviet first. Literally Soviet first in terms of supply. In fact, there was a very interesting American figure, someone I've tried to bring back into the history books. That would be a great success story if I could bring this man back, kind of recycle his reputation. A man named Major George Racy Jordan. His role throughout much of the war was to, quote, expedite the supply chain known as Lend-Lease that went straight through to the Soviet Union across the northern part of the country. He was based in Montana at a huge air base there. He actually kept in his pocket the orders he had from Washington that Soviet airplanes, Soviet supplies, were to take precedent even over American. And he often had to show these orders to American pilots who were going to be held up in this pipeline to defer to the Soviet front. This was the policy. This was something that was engineered, I do believe, by the influence of Roosevelt's top aide, a man named Harry Hopkins, who was in charge of Lend-Lease and indeed was instrumental in making it into this essential sort of giant sucking sound, is a metaphor we have from recent years, but this giant sucking sound taking American supplies, all manner of warships, industrial supplies, technical information, military secrets, plants, you know, the components of plants and all manner of stuff to the Soviet Union across the top and through very dangerous, treacherous seas where we would lose just untold numbers of seamen in this effort to keep the Soviet Union supplied. Meanwhile, it was told to the American people that it was too dangerous to try to resupply the Philippines, or the Philippines, General MacArthur was told supplies were on the way when nothing was on the way. And one of the most heartbreaking details I think I came across was this fact that MacArthur so believed President Roosevelt was sending supplies, of course, because he was being told they were on their way, that he was having men work 24 hours around the clock with bulldozers to bulldoze additional airstrips in the Philippines because he was expecting to be resupplied to such a strong extent. Nothing
absolutely came. Amazing. Absolutely. And now the interesting thing is MacArthur has this relationship with Roosevelt. He's communicating with him and Roosevelt's giving him these promises. But you mentioned Harry Hopkins. A lot of people don't know who Harry Hopkins was and what role he played. Tell us about him.
Harry Hopkins is the most important American, all of us, I had never heard of. He's the most important American we don't really know about. He slipped out of the history books essentially on the day he died, which was in January of 1946, right after the war. Harry Hopkins lived in the White House in the family quarters for 3 years, about 3.5 years during World War II. He had breakfast, lunch, and dinner with President Roosevelt. Indeed, when Winston Churchill came to town during the war, he had breakfast, lunch, and dinner with Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt. He was so powerful that he was considered by many reporters, it was just the common name, the co-president. Some people called him Rasputin. The people who didn't like him, detractors, people who didn't like Roosevelt. But his power was understood and completely a known quantity. It is amazing that he has no resonance today. I mean, I call it one of the great disappearing acts in history. He disappeared, and I think that there was a reason for that. He is someone, there is a controversy in the intelligence community over his status, whether he was a conscious agent of Stalin. Some people say he was an unconscious agent. I believe that the record that we only know by accident out of Soviet archives shows that he was acting in Stalin's interests, not American interests. And
now,
here's an
what
example.
What was his position? Yeah. Was he chief of staff? Was he an officer?
No.
He was a cabinet member?
At one time, he was, believe it or not, Commerce Secretary, which is kind of a joke, given that he was very socialistic in his own beliefs, fascistic, really. He did believe in government control of private industry in a very, more akin to a Mussolini-style fascism, perhaps, than the government actually owning the business and mechanisms of business. Gotcha. But he was Commerce Secretary for a short span. Most of the time he was in power, he was just an appointee. When he was essentially running much of the war, he didn't have an official portfolio. He was not confirmed. There was really no reason he was drawing a salary because he didn't really have a title, but he was. And again, he was living in the White House. His daughter was living there. When he married for a third time, his bride moved in. He was actually married in the Oval Study on the second floor of the family quarters that third time. So he was extraordinarily powerful. People said nothing could move in Washington without his initials on the order. And indeed, there's a strange point having to do with the Lend-Lease mechanism, where the American ambassador to the Soviet Union at one point is having trouble controlling some of Harry Hopkins' men in Moscow, and he insists to the president he must be put above them, and the president said, so ordered. And nothing would happen until the ambassador went to Harry Hopkins to ask for that to be done. I mean, this was the extent of his powers. He essentially ran Lend-Lease, which was the program to supply. We usually think of it as supplying the British, but the significant element of that supply line was to Soviet Russia. And Hopkins ran it in such a way with his own just layers of men loyal to him because he had put them into power. He ran it in such a way that suddenly the State Department was sort of extraneous. Suddenly the Senate didn't need treaty-making powers anymore. I mean, these were the kinds of executive overreach that began to be solidified in those Roosevelt years. And it was Hopkins that was the locus of power. And one development late in the game, in about 1998, I think it was, an Air Force historian named Edward Mark looked at one of the very famous, the Nona cables. And those are the cables that the Soviet diplomats would send back to Moscow that the Americans intercepted, originally hoping just to be able to be better allies if they could only understood what the Soviets really wanted. And then eventually the cryptographers in America understood that we were looking at this massive intelligence war against us. One of those cables was ultimately decrypted, but the name of the agent was not, and it was known as Source 19. And this Air Force historian, Edward Mark, wrote a tremendous paper essentially coming to about 99.9% conclusiveness that Source 19, feeding information to Stalin of a private meeting between Roosevelt and Winston Churchill, was indeed Harry Hopkins. But that is just the beginning of the dossier against him that I have in my book, American Betrayal. There is more evidence against him. And this is a staggering thought because of the implications it has for American policy during the war.
Well, there are those that believe Valerie Jarrett plays a similar role in the current administration.
Yes,
foreign American who has met with Iranian officials in Iran against all kinds of federal laws, and that's not the purpose of this program. I don't want to go into all that. But the thing that I want to point out here is that during World War II, you know, we were woefully caught with our shorts down. We were kind of practicing isolationism. We were saying we're not going to trade with anybody. We're not going to fight anybody. We're going to take care of ourselves and the world be hanged. And, you know, the Japanese drew us into the Pacific, and then we had to play the game of the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So we had the enemy, which was Nazi Germany, coming to power and taking over all of Europe with a mechanized war that we didn't understand. The communists hated Germany and then became our allies. And so supplying our allies wasn't really drawing that much suspicion. But on the other side of the fence, we had the Soviets that had completely different plans, not only to defeat Nazi Germany, but also to defeat America. And so the enemy of their enemy became their friend. And so their agents inside our country were weakening us at the same time that we were supplying them to help them take over half of Europe.
Well, that there are two points I'd like to go back to you on. One is on Japan drawing us into war in the Pacific. We know from the revelations out of the archives and memoirs of ex-Soviet or ex-KGB agents, slam dunk confirmed that the reason that we ended up at war with Japan at that time in December of 1941 had everything to do with a Soviet agent in the Treasury Department named Harry Dexter White inserting into the cable flow going between the American State Department and the government of Japan an ultimatum, the kind of language that would draw Japan to attack us. That language literally was written in Moscow. It was brought to Washington, D.C. by a Soviet handler named Pavlov, who met with Harry Dexter White at the old Ebbett Grill across the street from the Treasury Department. It's still there, wonderful, venerable old restaurant. Gave him the language. Harry Dexter White was eventually able to get it inserted into the state. It's strange, he's Treasury, but he was able to get it inserted into the State Department cable flow. And the point of this exercise, this brilliant exercise by Soviet KGB, because it was actually going on two continents. They had the same sort of exercise going on in Tokyo to empower the war party there to keep them aggressive against either America, Britain, or Holland at this point, in Dutch Indies and so on. The reason being the Soviet Union was trying to prevent Japan at that point on the warpath anywhere, everywhere, from attacking its eastern flank, attacking Siberia, attacking something in the north. And they were successful, and they brought the United States to war with Japan. So it's not entirely, in other words, we've already got Soviet infiltration affecting our war and peace at that early stage.
Right.
This only continued, and you're correct to point out the discrepancy in terms of our war goals, but it even goes farther than that. The U.S. and Britain believed that they were fighting a war to eliminate Hitler. Stalin, mm-hmm. however, was fighting a war to supplant Hitler. Stalin had to get into Europe. He had to occupy. He wanted a war in Europe. There's a wonderful Russian historian, Suvorov, who has written fantastic works about Stalin being he calls it the great culprit. That's one of his last, I think it is his last book, that sort of pulls a lot of his theories together. He does believe that Stalin was doing everything from the 30s on to create a war in Europe in order to be able to move his communist empire, expand it into Europe. Now, if you hang on to that thought for a moment, here's where you really get to the crux of betrayal, American betrayal. At a certain point, due to the infiltration of the Roosevelt administration, it became more important to appease Stalin and maintain a relationship with Stalin than it was to end the war early. And I discovered that there was plenty of evidence that there was every reason that that war could have been stopped, could have come to an end with Hitler defeated as early as 1943, perhaps even earlier. There were attempts even earlier, but 1943 seems to be a year it could have gelled. And there are a couple of statesmen, a military man, General Wiedemeyer, who's one of our top strategists of the war. He concluded this in his 1958 memoir. And there was also an emissary of Roosevelt, former Pennsylvania governor named George Earl, who served as Roosevelt's emissary in Europe during the war. He concluded this as well, 1943. And here's how. There was, and this was another shockaroo for me, I had not heard of this before. There was, in fact, a significant anti-Nazi German resistance. It went as high as the intelligence chief of Germany, a man named Canaris. It was in the clergy. It was in the military, high-level generals. It was business. There were different groups very eager to overthrow Hitler, starting in the 30s. The problem with them, as far as Washington, communist, actually, I argue, communist-occupied Washington. I argue that there were so many hundreds of agents in place by World War II, Washington, D.C. was de facto occupied by Moscow. So if you have so much communist penetration in Washington, D.C., that they identified the problem with the anti-Nazi German resistance, one problem, they were anti-communist. They always, the bargain they made every time they tried to make contact with us, and through different emissaries, including George Earle, and there were others, OSS, the precursor to CIA, other people, every time the bargain was the same. We will deliver you. We will surrender our armies to British and Americans. We'll deliver you German high command, the Nazis. We want help to keep the Russians out of Eastern Europe, out of Central Europe. And every time that failed, because you had communists who wanted the Red Army in Eastern and Central Europe.
So basically,
this is the point. Yeah.
Well, basically what you're saying is that these German higher-ups, and I assume that many of these were industrialists that had become military officers. They were intelligent. They were educated. They were loyal to Germany and not to Nazism, not to fascism. And they essentially went to our government officially for help. And whoever was designed to help them was told to stand down.
Yes, and I can give you a couple examples of where it was a Soviet agent. One instance was actually early in the war. The Berlin bureau chief for AP, a man named Lochner, an American, was mutual friends. He had a mutual friend with Roosevelt of Prince, a German prince. I believe it was Ferdinand, but I'd have to look it up. That doesn't sound like a German name. But there was a German prince that they both knew. And this prince asked Lochner on his way back to the United States for vacation or consultation or something in 1942 to please take these secret codes directly to the president. They wanted to set up communications so that the resistance could speak to the White House, and he also asked Roosevelt to give a speech saying what kind of Germany he envisioned and what sort of government he hoped to see one day and so on. Very specific kinds of recommendations. So Lochner dutifully comes back to Washington. He's, the Berlin bureau chief of AP. He's got important messages from wartime Germany. He can't get anywhere with that White House. He sends letters. He calls. He's blocked. Now, when I was looking at this, I was trying to, it's frustrating because, of course, there's not a document that says, I, communist agent, turned down Louis Lochner's request to meet with the president or something like that. You're not going to find that piece of paper. However, in a footnote of the source I was using, I found that at one point somebody called the AP and said, please ask Mr. Lochner to stop calling the White House. It's getting embarrassing. Words to that effect. And the footnote that I followed, took me to the back. This is a book published, I think, by about 1970. That White House aide was Lachlan Curry, a dead certain identified Soviet agent who was one of Roosevelt's top assistants. The man who wrote this book back around 1970 would not have known that he would be later confirmed in the archives that opened in the 90s as a dead-to-rights Soviet agent in the White House. But since I had the benefit of this hindsight, and, you should see my study, stacks and stacks, I saw this, and, it was just, there was an excitement of discovery, but it was also, just a kick in the gut, because the notion that war might have been concluded earlier with the millions and millions of people and the cities that had not yet been firebombed is just one of the great tragedies of our world. And this was repeated over the next year or two with different Americans very naively perhaps thinking that they could come home with a bargain or send home a bargain and do something that would bring that war to an end. But it becomes very clear that in the Roosevelt level, the top level of the government, the war had to continue. It had to continue because in 1943, the Red Army was still in Russia. It had not come into Europe yet.
Sure.
And this became the goal. And so you're looking at this stuff, for example, the unconditional surrender conference at Casablanca of January 1943, where Roosevelt comes up with unconditional surrender. Well, our military generals were all saying, and the Secretary of State at the time, who had not been told, Cordell Hull, were all saying, what are you saying? Unconditional surrender at this stage, that just makes people fight more and fight longer and fight harder. similarly, at the end of that year, when the Morgenthau plan, which was a plan again with Harry Dexter White, the agent behind it, the plan to, they call it, pastoralize Germany, essentially destroy German industry, that in a plan that would have certainly starved millions of Germans just by the mechanism of the plan. When that plan leaked out, you had generals saying, "I can't believe how hard the Germans are fighting." I mean, this is the kind of activity that the agents were able to put over that I believe prolonged the war. Sure. I believe the evidence shows.
And motivated them to work even harder. And a lot of people, you know, missed the fact that Germany was already under the reparations of the Treaty of Versailles. And so the industrialists and bankers that were trying to, you know, make money in Germany, because Germany was a very industrious country. They had mines, they had lots of machinery that they could produce, and we had American industries helping them and financing them and giving them technology and training to get them back and up and on their feet. Of course, they were making weapons with that know-how and that investment, but that's beside the point. The point is that you know, and a lot of people don't know that Germany just paid off the reparations, I think, just about 2 years ago. Mm. They finally paid the last of it off. But while all this is going on, while all this industrial, you know, I'm going to call it profiteerism, is going on in Europe, Roosevelt, for the last, well, since 1933, had implemented this massive social program that involved the creation of about 13 new agencies out of whole cloth. So he was creating a professional voter class, voting public that was literally bought and paid for with soup and bread and whatever else kind of propaganda that they were putting out domestically, because they controlled all the media. And there was, if you think the media today is bought and paid for, you should have been president in 1933 when the press did whatever the president told them to do. So you have these two conflicting things that are going on in Roosevelt's head and his health declining, and you have a tremendously intelligent, tremendously well-financed, and tremendously well-placed Harry Hopkins having soft-boiled eggs every morning with the president.
Right, right. You know, it was just a you know, to call it a recipe for disaster is trite, I know, but it was just a global train wreck. But people, you know, the press, there certainly was the fawning Roosevelt press corps. There was a significant anti-Roosevelt press corps. You know, the Roosevelt haters, they were the despised so-called isolationist press. They were trying to get a handle on what was going on, and they were certainly anti-communist, anti-socialist, and very disturbed by the Bolshevizing impact of the New Deal. I mean, this was no common language at the time. Hopkins, you know, it was interesting. He came into the administration as a social worker. That actually was his background. And then, lo and behold, by the time the war comes, he's all of a sudden a military strategist. It's the darndest thing. You know, you see him sitting in on these commander-in-chief level meetings and essentially promoting, boosting strategy with no background, no military background, certainly no strategic study, understanding, nothing like that, just in there. And it's very interesting to see the kinds of military strategies that he pushed. And one of them, this is going to sound very odd to people, but again, looking at the, I always kept going back to the map. There are a few points in the book where I just, you know, with all of the sort of cacophony and propaganda that you're reading and so on, go to the map. Look at the map. The logic of the map is always very clarifying. For example, there was a great argument, as you know, between Churchill on the one hand and Roosevelt and Stalin on the other about where the major invasion of Europe by the British and the Americans should be. And, you know, most school children, high school kids certainly, at some point come to this in the U.S. history books, the dispute over the invasion of Europe. Should it be in Normandy and in northwest France, or should it be through this, what Churchill famously called the soft underbelly of Europe, coming up through the middle Italy, Yugoslavia area. That takes you right into Central Europe through Austria and so on and on toward Germany. Well, the Stalin side of things and the Hopkins side of things always, from the very beginning, even before Americans were anywhere except the Philippines, in other words, before there was any American invasion during the war, were always pushing France, northern France. Had to be France. Second front. This was the mantra. Second front. Had to be France. Now, the interesting thing was that, you know, life doesn't happen without strange twists. And sure enough, the British very unexpectedly, in this June of 1942, had a devastating defeat in Tobruk in North Africa. And they were in retreat. Other holdings were threatened by the German army at that point winning. And all of a sudden, northern France was not the greatest idea that Hopkins and Stalin ever had. And indeed, this is considered one of the only military decisions that Roosevelt is said to have made himself, without Hopkins and General Marshall, who was Hopkins' crony, I would add, the then also Army Chief of Staff. This took American troops into North Africa, then on to, following the logic of that success, into Sicily, into Italy. Now, you'd think we're looking at front number two in North Africa. Nope, that didn't count. How about Sicily? Nope, this is Stalin. And their headlines, I found them rather funny in a way. I have a whole bunch of headlines of the day where Stalin is constantly rejecting these different second fronts as second fronts. It had to be northern France. So these wars, in other words, did not count. Even though you had over 100,000 men under arms, you had these massive invasions going, nope, wasn't a second front. And he's constantly putting pressure to come into northern France. Then they get into Italy. Same argument. You're on the mainland. It was an extraordinary thing. And I found this kind of funny letter from a letter writer to the New York Times in about, I don't know, 1943, who said, you know, I'm getting tired of this second front talk. By my count, we're at the ninth front. they're still talking about a second front.
You look, and I look at it as a project manager would look at a conflict like that, where you're feeding resources and assets and training people and having to deal with several different commands. And, you know, Germany was really brilliant in their strategy in that they went into Africa to secure fuel supplies so that they could literally fuel their mechanized war. And they really went in unopposed. The British were woefully outgunned, and they didn't have tanks to operate in the sand. They didn't have aircraft. They didn't have anything. And the Germans were using radar and all kinds of things to gain advantage. And it wasn't until the Americans got involved against Rommel, which, you know, Patton was famous and a movie was made about it. And they fought, you know, they fought tactically like generals would fight. Huge amounts of assets. And then we bombed the crap out of Ploesti, which is one of the biggest oil refineries down there. And it was a terrible, terrible theater in which to fight. It was one where you had to have a constant flow of resources, not the least of which is fresh water, or everybody dies. And, you know, we came through it. And in doing so, really crippled Germany's war machine, because it relied heavily upon aircraft, trains, tanks, and they required lots and lots of diesel fuel to run. So
here's the thing. If I could just get the sort of the payoff on this, which is that you finally have the armies, the Allied armies, the British and Americans in Italy. And that's not a second front. And you still have the pressure to essentially, this is where things really started gelling for me. I was reading General Mark Clark's memoir, Calculated Risk, and he's very frank about this. And it's a very clarifying kind of read. You had to withdraw out of Italy to reinvade Europe in Normandy. Now, I had just gone through, you know, standard history courses. I'd read the standard histories after college and all of that and, you know, continued an interest but hadn't become a student of this, just, you know, absorbing the general tale that we sort of all know. I had always thought, and my father was actually in the Normandy invasion, I had always looked at Normandy as the invasion of Europe. I had never considered the fact that we had invaded Europe through Italy, through Sicily. We were coming up. And this was sort of like a mind game, I realized, in the sense of what had really gone on. And I read, there was a history book I read by Dennis Dunn, who wrote a very good history of this period, and he actually has the line. So in effect, we had to pull out of Europe in order to re-invade Europe from the northwest. And what the strategists said who were upset about this was, you took us out of the middle of Europe where we came closest to Germany and indeed would have posed a counterweight to the Red Army coming in from the east. And this, of course, is where Churchill, at a certain point, you know, he's got the light bulb going off on this same problem, that there was no way to stop the Red Army. But what also becomes clear, it wasn't just Normandy that did put the kibosh on that central, that sort of soft underbelly strategy. Stalin, at a certain point, came up with an additional invasion of southern France, known as Anvil, that would take the sort of the coup de grace. In fact, General Clark talks about that. It wasn't the Normandy supply and giving them the invading craft, landing craft and so on that broke the back of his very stretched army. It was actually the final blow was to muster the troops and equipment necessary for that southern invasion of France that eventually came. And this, I think, was the most amazing thing. At that point, when our troops, Americans and British in Italy, had been removed to a point, or mainly Americans had been removed for this French invasion, the Germans could not figure out where we'd gone. And you had Americans capturing German intelligence spies, essentially, looking for the American army all over Italy. They could not believe that we had not followed the German army and taken the kill.
Yeah, they thought that we were hiding in the Alps somewhere.
They thought we had some incredible plan, and they kept saying, where the hell are you guys? And they would go everywhere and get picked up, and they would be debriefed and say, we don't know where you are. What'd you do? And they could not believe that we would be so stupid as to not follow them and destroy the army. But again, this is part of the logic, because what happens when the bulk of the American invasion is so far to the west, it leaves Central and Eastern Europe open for the Red Army. And I do believe that this was a plan, that Stalin was a brilliant strategist. He knew this was the way he wanted it. Hopkins, it's very strange when you see his obsession with France. Why? A social worker. Why doesn't he defer to military strategists? Why doesn't he defer even to Churchill's expertise? Roosevelt, too, was very open, sort of oddly so, given the pressures that were on him. He was very open to continuing operations in the Mediterranean, in that Yugoslav region and so on. It's an amazing influence operation I do believe we're looking at. But this, of course, is more speculative. I understand that. But I do set it up with the evidence that we have. And when you put it in concert, just going back to Hopkins, I would like to tell one story about why I do think Hopkins was a conscious agent of the Soviet Union. And it had to do with the FBI was eavesdropping on a conversation taking place in Berkeley, California, which is where a good bit of atomic research was going on at the time, into the hush-hush-hush Manhattan Project. The FBI wasn't even aware of the Manhattan Project at this point. In fact, this was their first inkling that there was something big going on in terms of a new invention, a new military invention. And they heard the third-level diplomat of the Soviet embassy, a man named Zubilin, in a conversation with a known American underground agent, discussing infiltration of military industry, passing money to him, and so on. And it was kind of a lengthy conversation that they were able to record, pass on to their higher-ups in the FBI. And J. Edgar Hoover, director of the FBI, wrote a confidential note to President Roosevelt and Harry Hopkins, again, showing how important he was, telling him about this right away, identifying Zubilin as the highest-ranking Comintern agent in the United States. His other name was Zerubin. I think that was actually his real name. And what did Harry Hopkins do with that? He went to the Soviet embassy and told them the FBI was wiretapping them. And the only reason we know that comes from the Matrokhin archive, one of the archives that we had after a man named Matrokhin, a KGB agent, absconded with archives of the KGB in the 90s. So in other words, we know about this by accident. Harry Hopkins covered his tracks very well, but we did find out he had absolutely no claim to ignorance because Hoover told him this man was the top Comintern agent trying to get military secrets. Hopkins, again, takes that information, goes straight to the Soviet embassy.
Well, I'm floored because now one last question, and then we're gonna take about a 5 minute break because we got to let affiliations take place, and then we'll come back and we're gonna really get into this Manhattan Project and what went on. What year was this FBI wiretap made?
1943.
2 years before any nuclear weapon would be used in battle, and an easy year before the first nuclear detonation inside the United States. That is really, really stunning. All right, Diana, hang with us. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back in about 5 minutes. Don't go away. More Diana West, author of American Betrayal and X Squared Radio. Be right back. Welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, coming to you from just outside of Charlotte, North Carolina. My guest tonight is Diana West, author of American Betrayal. If you missed the first hour, you definitely need to go back and listen to this as an archive, because you missed a lot. We're going to change gears in this hour and talk a little bit about the Manhattan Project and what went on there. There's so much amazing revelations in her book. And it's a fascinating project to begin with because of the so many layers of secrecy, and that automatically lends itself to all kinds of espionage, which there certainly was. Before we get into that, I want to remind you our affiliate, The Food Investor, out in Utah, my friends Scott and Danny Barzee, are producing dehydrated foods that make excellent food storage items, great taste without preservatives. So this is a great set-it-and-forget-it food storage program. You buy it, put it in a bag by the front door, and it is ready to go anytime. You know, he's one of our favorite affiliates, and so please click on the Food Investor link at X Squared Radio. Also, wanted to remind you that in October, the Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference is coming up, and there are going to be so many firsts at this conference. It's really amazing. Not only will there be leading-edge breakthrough energy projects and technologies that you can look at. Some of them can be used for the home, for your car, for all kinds of devices. It'll just get your mind working for all kinds of things you could use this stuff for. But also, Atlas Shrugged is going to have a presence there. There's a strong rumor that the trailer for Atlas Shrugged 3 will make its secret debut at the conference. And there'll be electric vehicles and all kinds of other neat stuff. It's going to be held in Boulder, Colorado, October 10th. If you want to find the link, it's easy. Just go to X Squared Radio. Right there in the center below the slideshow is a link to the Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference. Get there. Get registered. It's easy to find. Welcome back, Diana. We're having an
Thank
amazing
you.
I'm kind of a history hobbyist, I'm going to call it, because I'm a scientist and I love reading stuff. But I become fascinated when history becomes altered, becomes washed over, becomes propagandized or approved and sanitized. And when documents of old begin to come forward and say, hey, wait a minute, that's not only not the whole story, that it isn't even close to the true story. That's when we really learn our weakness. That's when we begin to learn, hey, maybe we are repeating history because we're not telling the truth about what we did. And that's why I find your book, it's going to be fascinating when I get to read the whole thing. It's so new, folks. I haven't even had a chance to get my copy in yet. It's ordered, but it hasn't arrived yet. It just went live on Amazon, like, I don't know, 4 days ago. So it's rocketing to the top of the charts right now, I am sure. In this hour, I want to talk about the Manhattan Project. We just very briefly touched on it because of the espionage that took place inadvertently when the FBI tapped a communication. And they learned about a project that was so massive and so technical and so complex that even they didn't know was happening inside our country. And who did the cable go to when they discovered this? It went to the president and to Mr. Hopkins, which then went straight to the Soviets and let them know, hey, by the way, you guys just got tapped. So maybe they just got smarter after that. What do you think happened?
I think they continued on their merry way. I mean, they were not impeded. They were, in fact, assisted, again, by Harry Hopkins. I mean, this is kind of the truly another instance of just major American betrayal. We know about the famous Rosenberg spy ring. We know about the Soviet espionage. You know, we've read many books following this. Many documents reveal the various treasons involved. I mean, this is kind of an old story to us. What is not an old story to us, however, is the involvement of the Lend-Lease establishment, the machinery of this agency, in terms of providing the ingredients required for an atomic pile. I mean, this is literally what also went along that pipeline. And this is the story, again, of a man named Major George Racy Jordan, who I realize is so far the only American witness to come forward and claim that he witnessed Harry Hopkins in what he later realized was an act of treason. And just to refresh, Jordan was known as an expediter. He was the top American officer at this major air base in Great Falls, Montana, that was just speeding aircraft and supplies, just tons and tons of supplies, along the way through Alaska and then over into the Soviet Union during the war. And Jordan was all for it. I mean, he was a patriot. He was supporting his country in its war effort. He was actually had come back into service. He was not a young man. He was had been in World War One. I understand he actually was a flyer with Eddie Rickenbacker. He was a businessman. He came back into the uniform and was doing his job. And he was the liaison to the Soviet presence in Great Falls. And he ended up keeping notes, diaries, jottings of all manner of things while he was there. And this really became the best American record of what the Lend-Lease pipeline was like. He published a book, Harcourt at the time, in 1952, called From Major Jordan's Diaries. And this is the story, his story of Lend-Lease. The public became aware of this first in 1949. This was the year that the Soviet Union shocked America by exploding an atomic bomb. And as the news broke and the discussions went on about how this could have happened and what was happening, Jordan came to understand by the various technical language that was suddenly in play that he had personally expedited essential ingredients, essential materials that went into the making of the Soviet bomb, including uranium. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that's stunning because, you know, I did my postgrad work at Oak Ridge. And
I'm talking to the right man.
One of my suppliers that gave me things like sodium iodide crystals and detector software and stuff like that, because I used it to develop a ground probing radar system for oil and gas industry. Anyway, he was a major in the Marines, and his job was to supervise the Manhattan Project team for security, not only to make sure they were kept safe, but also to make sure they didn't speak to anybody. And he told me just wonderful stories about those days. And one of the things that I discovered was in pursuing my nuclear chemistry degree was that no two fissile materials are identical. When these things are enriched, and they're the way to do that is you speed up neutrons with a very powerful centrifuge, electromagnetic centrifuge, and you slam them into the uranium. You enrich the uranium. Normally it's uranium-235, but by the time you finish loading it up with neutrons, it's really hot stuff. It's fissile material. It's very, very close to criticality when you compress it. And the first ideas about making an atomic bomb was to make what's called an atomic gun, where you take two chunks of uranium at either end of a tube and you literally use the tube as a cannon and you shoot the two pieces of uranium at each other inside that tube. And just from the concussion, there is some fission that takes place and the whole thing comes apart. It goes critical and comes apart. After that, they learned to make shaped charges, and it wasn't until they confiscated quite advanced German prototypes of a very similar bomb that they were able to make huge leaps forward in technology. Of course, even that is a very secret even to this day. But there are a lot of other components that you got to have. You got to have precision aluminum tubes, and you got to have heavy...
Can I interrupt one moment?
Yeah, absolutely.
Jordan Yes, Jordan. One thing Jordan did was he got the Russians. He was very palsy-walsy with them, his counterpart, and he got the Russians to turn over essentially their manifest, their lists of what had been supplied, and he prints them in his book. And from my research, it's the best listing of Lend-Lease that I've seen anywhere, and these were what the Soviets gave him. One of the items was more than $13 million worth of aluminum tubes. A lot
That's aluminum tubes this year.
Sorry?
That's a lot of aluminum tubes in that year. $13 million went a long, long way. By the way,
yep.
Who supplied the aluminum?
I don't know. I don't know where the aluminum came from. Something else he shipped along, this will mean something to you as well, 834,000 pounds of cadmium metal, which I understand is necessary for controlling the intensity of the atomic pile. 13,000 pounds of thorium. This was just various shipments. And what is amazing is that General Leslie Groves, the chief of the Manhattan Project, did not know this, certainly about uranium, until 1949 and 1950 when Jordan went to testify before Congress. General Groves had slapped an embargo on uranium, specifically in 1943, after a shipment had gone through to the Soviets, something Jordan was actually not aware of, no longer could U.S. uranium be exported. And indeed, the uranium that Jordan shipped, at Harry Hopkins' request, he says he got a phone call from Harry Hopkins about it, came from Canada. So in other words, Hopkins was going around the embargo placed by General Groves on the export of uranium.
That's why everything was going out through Canadian ports. And I maintain that the aluminum came from one of the Third Reich's major suppliers, Alcoa.
And where was that?
Alcoa was the largest aluminum supplier in the United States.
Ah. Very likely. I couldn't tell you.
Well, it's just kind of interesting how all this falls together. By the way, the first detonation was the atomic gun, but the second one was a fusion weapon where they were actually forcing hydrogen protons together to make helium and thus releasing the energy. This was Einstein's brainchild, and the shape charge and the tritium enriching that they used for that bomb made a bomb of amazing intensity, but they actually didn't know if they would light the atmosphere on fire when they set it off.
Wow.
So it was kind of a tense moment for everyone.
I bet.
it's widely known now that the actual detonator for the bomb that was dropped on Nagasaki came from Germany.
Amazing.
Now, the interesting thing is, and this is kind of a surprise because we know now after listening to the first hour and by paying close attention to the map, that the eastern flank was left open, that the troops that had been so successful beating Germany's armies up in South Africa made their way across the Med into Italy and were poised to go up through the center of Europe, right through the soft underbelly. And at the last moment, we're told to get back on boats, get back through the Med, go through the Straits of Gibraltar, go all the way around Spain because we're coming in on the northwest of France.
Right.
Even the Germans could not figure out where we were. So stupid was the strategy.
Yeah.
But it was perfect, perfect for an eastern invasion by Soviet Russia.
Exactly, exactly. It's a shocking thing to have to confront. But I think it is, again, the logic of the map, and now we have various forms of evidence that show this very evil plan taking shape, various players working for it. Meanwhile, you did have, and this is kind of the, I don't know if it's the uplift part of the book, but the inspiring, the part I find inspiring, you did have along the way a series of people that I call the truth tellers, who saw from wherever their piece of real estate was, they saw what was going on, and they tried to tell the truth either to the American people or to the president. And he had advisors, people who were tried to be honest with him and tell him exactly what was happening with the Soviet Union, that this policy of appeasement would actually result in America having gone to war to defeat one monster and instead defeat that monster but leave an even greater monster in power. And this is exactly what happened. Again, when I started thinking about it, I realized that this notion of, quote, the good war that we always are taught World War II is, the morally black and white war, was another whitewash. How, again, going to the map, can one look at that map at the end of World War II and claim victory? Yes, Hitler was gone. However, the division of Europe that Hitler and Stalin had secretly arranged in the the Nazi-Soviet Pact of 1939 was absolutely in sway. Only Stalin was holding the territories. It was an absolute flim-flam game, and it was the wool was pulled over our eyes, and you know, it has only gotten more and more difficult to see the truth because as time goes by, you know, the memories diminish and the narrative, the lore is set. It's set in stone now. And so, in a sense, you know, it's I think it is time for a reappraisal for sure, and that is what I offer in the book. But it's a difficult one because it essentially requires people to invert the universe.
Well, I think that your book is, you know, like water, and it's going to get into the cracks of this stone wall, and it's going to break it apart. It is that powerful. The book is called American Betrayal, and the title, as we discussed in very early in the first hour, was not the title of the original book outline that Diana started with, but it became the title as she discovered, just as you're being stunned right now by learning this, she was learning it in volumes and in reams of information that she digested to write this incredible book. Now, let's talk a little bit about those truth tellers, because some of them were contemporaries and some of them came along later as the history is being written. But what happened to the truth tellers in a Washington, D.C. that is not only completely infiltrated with Soviet spies, but is almost operating like a de facto Stalin supply chain? What happened to truth tellers in that environment?
Well, they tended to be chewed up and spat out, and depending on their own position and resources, they, you know, landed according to, you know, according to how hard life would treat them. For example, in terms of thinking of the one of the truth tellers is George Earl, this man I had mentioned earlier as being a former New Deal governor of Pennsylvania, came from a fancy family, kind of a swashbuckling type, and he had been one of Roosevelt's emissaries in Europe, came up with evidence of another betrayal we have not talked about yet, evidence that the Soviets had indeed perpetrated what's known as the Katyn Forest Massacre. This was the mass murder of some 20,000 Polish officers by the Soviets early in the war. And when the Germans reclaimed the area, Katyn, actually more recently in the headlines as Smolensk, which is the nearby city, because of the, some call it the assassination of the Polish leadership by Putin 3 years ago in a plane crash to commemorate the Katyn Forest Massacre, if you can imagine that. When they discovered the Germans reclaimed that territory and began unearthing the bodies of the dead Polish officers, they, in, you know, kind of kettle calling pot black style, were trumpeting to the world this Soviet atrocity. Now, the Soviet atrocity was committed by our Uncle Joe. That was Stalin's nickname by Roosevelt and Churchill, this disgusting nickname. They called him Uncle Joe. This was part of the propaganda. And it presented the Churchill and Roosevelt with a real conundrum, a moral quandary. And the way that they actually faced that quandary was to join the Soviet lie, was to participate in a big lie. Even at that date, it was possible to assess the evidence on the ground in Katyn and understand that only the Soviets could have committed this atrocity. And George Earl was someone who, in his travels, had amassed a dossier on Katyn, and he thought it was very important that the president know. And he came back to Washington, I believe it was about 1944 when he had this meeting, and he presented his dossier to Roosevelt. And Roosevelt was, you know, as you mentioned earlier, very ill, really non compos mentis at least half the time. Stanton Evans has a wonderful new book called Stalin's Secret Agents, and he argues that, you know, Roosevelt was essentially brain dead the closer you get to the end of the war. Roosevelt dismissed Earl. Earl came back and actually asked permission to tell his truth, what he had discovered, and warned the American people that a new totalitarian entity was forming that would threaten us. And Roosevelt ordered him into silence, and Earl was also a go-between with that anti-Hitler German resistance we were talking about, so he'd really been through the internal wars with this administration. And what did Roosevelt do next? Earl went fishing after this terrible debacle, and he was fishing on a remote Maryland lake. It sounds extremely rural, out in a little boat. And what do you know but a couple of FBI agents get in a little boat and putt-putt across the lake over to him, present him with his literal marching orders, and he was dispatched to Samoa. That's one way to get a truth teller out of town.
Wow.
Samoa. Another man early on, he's actually in the very beginning of the book, a man named William Wirt had this is before the war, early depression, Roosevelt administration just in, New Deal just taking shape. William Wirt goes to a New Deal dinner party and hears revolution being planned. It's quite an extensive experience he had, and he began writing letters everywhere he could. He was an educator of note, so he had some standing. And one of his letters got to James Rand, an industrialist of note, at the time testifying before the, I guess, the Securities and Exchange Committee at the time, rewriting Wall Street according to New Deal standards. And Rand read the letter into the congressional record alleging revolution on the part of the New Dealers. And there were hearings. They were, I call them the very first show trial in America. Wirt was railroaded. He was not allowed to read his statement. He was not allowed counsel, which was a Senate tradition. He was not allowed to summon witnesses to prove whether what he was saying was true or not. The dinner party guests, we later find out, again, due to the opening of archives, three out of the six were KGB assets. They colluded in a story and told the world under oath that Wirt had not stopped talking and was the biggest bore and it was the worst dinner party ever. And Wirt was smeared and they say died of a broken heart. He left. He went back to his home in Indiana. A few years later, one of the Democrats on that committee that, in his words, turned the thumbscrews on Wirt, wrote a public confession admitting that there had been collusion in the stories, and that the Democrats had been there solely to shut the story down so that the New Deal would not be stopped.
And so
we don't know about him. He's not in our history books either. So this is what happens to them. Basically, they are marginalized, and then they are paved over. And history doesn't tell us about them unless you start digging.
And one of the things that we know about history in that time was that this agency government, this New Deal, which you hear about in your history books when you're in high school and junior high, this agency government that was established was set up so that secretaries, which the Constitution allows the president to have a cabinet, which are, you know, advisors, people that know stuff, because the president can't know everything, and it doesn't, you know, mean anything if they're aligned with him or not. Preferably they are, because he's seeking advice from them as he runs things. But when Roosevelt came to power as the, you know, world-famous governor of New York, he was really a public figure. And the nation was in such terrible shape because the middle class had been completely evaporated after the 1929 crash. Then you had billionaires and you had paupers, and that was about it. But you needed some kind of social plan to pull the people under the wing of the government so that the government would create this dependent class of voters. But the secretaries took the orders directly from the president. So, in essence, what happened was the balance of powers between the legislative and the executive and judicial branches was tilted all in the favor of the executive branch. The president ran everything, and Harry Hopkins ran the president.
That's about it. And indeed, it was like he opened up a foreign office in the White House. Again, taking powers from the State Department, taking powers from the Senate. And when you look at the wartime conferences, whether it was Roosevelt and Churchill or Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin, the high-level meetings were with the principals, you know, the actual presidents or dictator, as the case may be, prime minister, and their foreign secretaries. In the American case, the American Secretary of State never, Cordell Hull, never participated in a conference. It was always Harry Hopkins. In Yalta, at the end, Cordell Hull was already gone. You did have the American Secretary of State, Edward Stettinius, attend. However, Stettinius was essentially a Hopkins empty suit. He was essentially elevated by Hopkins. He had run Lend-Lease for a time as a figurehead, and he was also enthralled to another man we have not yet mentioned, and his name was Alger Hiss. So at Yalta, even though, yes, there was someone from the State Department, he was a puppet. There's just no question about it. And in the other wartime conferences, the foreign minister for the United States, we don't have such a thing, but the person acting as that was Harry Hopkins. The State Department didn't even show up.
Well, now in 1945, a big surprise happens. It surprised the scientists. It surprised the pilots that dropped it. It definitely surprised the Japanese. But I would like to know if you found out in your investigations if it was a surprise to the Soviets when the two bombs went off in Japan, and did they change their plans because of it?
It was not a surprise. And in fact, when Truman spoke to Stalin at Potsdam, which was the conference right after the end of the war in Europe, and told him about the the bomb, he was very completely unsurprised. He seemed to have prior knowledge. Now, I did find something even more interesting than that, because of course Stalin could have just been pretending, I suppose, you know, and trying not to seem shocked about this. But I found
little bomb.
There was a. I'm sorry.
I was going to say I could hear him saying, "We know about your little bomb."
Yeah, right. Exactly. And he may or may not have been telling the truth. However, there was a very famous wartime correspondent named W.L. White. And he wrote of a 1944 exchange. This was obviously before the detonation of our atomic bomb over Japan. And he wrote of this exchange he had with a Soviet guide. He went over there to write a book about what was going on. And he was being taken around. And his guide was referring, he specifically used the words cyclotrons, splitting of atom, and Manhattan Project in casual conversation.
Wow.
And White... Yes, White had no idea what he was talking about when he said Manhattan Project, and he had this kind of hilarious exchange, you know, thinking, you know, I don't know that club. I mean, you can imagine Manhattan Project. He thought he put it all down to a lack of language miscommunication, and he wrote about that experience later on. Another more evidence about this, again, came from the Lend-Lease supply line. This was something that George Racy Jordan testified about in Congress. He testified twice, once in late 1949 and once again in 1950. He came back essentially to defend his honor at this point because he had been so maligned. One of the things that came up after his first testimony, which of course included charges that Harry Hopkins and the whole Lend-Lease mechanism had been pressuring the delivery of atomic materials through to the Soviet Union. And indeed, General Groves testified that he was under tremendous pressure from the Lend-Lease organization to do the same thing and to be more, compliant. One of the things he discussed was an amazing night in Montana in the winter when his Russian counterparts hosted him for the only time they ever did this in town for kind of a chicken and vodka dinner, okay? And Jordan told the people back at the base, the other Americans, don't let any planes take off for Russia while I'm at dinner. He was getting suspicious at that point. And sure enough, he called up and found out that there was a plane that the Soviets were trying to fly out. And he left the party without saying goodbye and drove careening down the mountain, the Montana empty road, back to the air base in the dark of winter, and ran out onto the tarmac where the plane was revving up, and poked his head up into the plane and came across these Soviet guards with all of these cheap black suitcases. This is how they carried a lot of their supplies and a lot of their mail. Well, mail, a lot of the stolen records, stolen documents, stolen plans, and so on. And he decided it was going to be that night or never. He was going to look inside and see what they had. And he didn't have gloves. He describes this frigid night, and he starts opening them up. But first, because the pilots are so upset and they're yelling, diplomatique, diplomatique, as if to say you can't touch the diplomatic stuff, he called over a soldier on patrol, an American, and he came running over through the snow, and he said, I'm going to open this baggage, and I want you to watch these two Russians. They're armed. If one of them aims a gun at me, I want you to let him have it first. Understand? And the soldier looked him in the eye and said, sir, is that an order? And Jordan said, yep, that's an order. So he starts going through the documents, and he sees maps pinpointing American industrial sites, maps of the Panama Canal, documents related to the Aberdeen Proving Ground, which was a very sensitive effort in the war, sensitive area in the war effort, all of this naval and shipping intelligence, papers on oil refineries, machine tools, it goes on and on, documents from the State Department, documents from the American Embassy in Russia that had come back and then were now returning to Russia to Soviet hands. Then he gets to a very thick map that he testified said Oak Ridge, Manhattan Engineering District. Now, he didn't know what Oak Ridge was. He's just writing this down. And he also found strange papers referring to things with weird words he hadn't heard, cyclotron again, and things about, neutrons and fission, these strange words. And that's where he said for the first time in his life he saw the word uranium. So this is Jordan's testimony about what he saw going through. He also testified that he saw a note with the initials HH saying, had a hell of a time getting these away from Groves, and these were attached to the Manhattan District plans. Now this, he testified to, it became a huge controversy, and mainly the Hopkins was dead at this point, and his defenders, of which there were legion, were saying, oh, he never signed his name HH. He always said HLH. Jordan's a fraud, just based on that. And now they didn't allow the investigators from Congress to investigate all the archives to see if they could find an HH. But they did come up with a couple of, many documents perhaps, but a lot of HHs. But they made this huge point about it had to be HLH because Harry Hopkins' middle name began with an L. Well, when I was doing my research, I was in the Georgetown archives. Georgetown University has Harry Hopkins' papers. And I found a couple of very interesting things while I was there. One of them was I found a note signed by Harry Hopkins, HH. So, just for the record, he did sign his name sometimes HH. But as Jordan said at the time, he said, "What? They wouldn't attack me if I had had the right initials." That wasn't the basis of it. One of Hopkins' main assistants, who's actually still living, a man named Sidney Hyman, he's about 96 or 7 years old now, he organized Hopkins' papers for the very famous biography that Robert Sherwood wrote about him at this time. It was a huge bestseller one of the, it's Book of the Month Club, you know, big book in the late 40s. Just had come out about a year earlier. And Sidney Hyman told Newsweek that Harry Hopkins, it couldn't have been Harry Hopkins involved in this because Harry Hopkins, quote, didn't know uranium from geranium. Now, I've been through that Hopkins biography so much because it's a very important book. And believe me, Harry Hopkins knew plenty about uranium. Harry Hopkins, and Sidney Hyman knew this because he had put the papers together for Sherwood. Harry Hopkins was the liaison between Vannevar Bush, the scientist, the lead scientist on Manhattan Project, and President Roosevelt. And he was the liaison on the Manhattan Project between President Roosevelt and Winston Churchill right from the start. He knew everything that was going on and indeed was quite fascinated by it, as the book makes very clear. So here you see a Hopkins crony doing his best to make the story go away, doing his best to make Hopkins unimportant.
It's not unlike what we see this happening in our own government right now. We see cronies in the White House, whether they're in the State Department or whether they're in the press, doing their best to say, oh, that's old news, you know, let it go away. We need to go back to the business of America. And we also see diplomats and other important people being left, behind.
Right.
So it's still going on today, and we're not learning our lessons. By the way, one of my listeners and friends says that her father, Lieutenant John D. Paulus Jr., was the designer of the electrical system for the Manhattan Project, and he was told it was a design for a new battleship for planes to land on. And she found his original drawing when he passed away. He never knew about the project until the bomb dropped. So secrecy was held at all kinds of levels. And now, you mentioned that that he was testifying. Where was he testifying? Were these congressional hearings that were trying to find out who leaked the information to the Russians and why they were able to blow up a bomb in 1949?
Yes. If you give me 1 second, I can get the exact committee name. It was looking into how this had happened. It was looking into whether there had been espionage. And they, of course, interviewed Jordan because he had claimed and was able to prove he had shipped uranium. He was also able to prove he had shipped heavy water. The congressional investigators were able to find shipping labels. They were able to find the number of the airplane that actually flew it out. When his story broke, he was able to, people came forward with different pieces of confirmation. For example, the pilot, a man named Ben Brown, who flew the uranium out, actually, you'll appreciate this, actually claimed, he didn't have to testify, he just told reporters, that in moving cases around, one of the cases opened up and this brownish grain spilled out. And he started to pick it up. And one of the Russians who was on the flight said, "No, stop, burn hands, don't touch."
Yeah, exactly. That's enriched uranium, and it's pouring neutrons off of it. And that's one of the reasons you use the cadmium or lead, is to absorb those neutrons so that you can contain it while you're transporting it and putting it into cases. Now, not all this stuff left by plane. Some of this, like the aluminum tubes, and you're talking, you know, maybe millions of pounds of stuff that was shipped out. A lot of this went by sea, did it not?
Yes, but a lot of you hear about shipments of thousands of pounds, 4,000 pounds. Corroborators of Jordan's story was a very famous ex-Soviet official named Viktor Kravchenko, who wrote a couple of very, very important books, most famous, I Chose Freedom. He actually defected from Lend-Lease during the war. And in 43 or 44, he walked out of the Soviet Lend-Lease building on 16th Street in Washington, D.C. one day and never came back. And he had to go underground because the Soviets were after him. Harry Hopkins wanted to find him and considered him a deserter from Russia. He used the word deserter to refer to Kravchenko. Yes. Kravchenko actually discussed in his own testimony before Congress that he had helped the leading kind of tubing scientist of the day for the Soviets. His name was Semenenko. Packing up plans regarding, you know, these tubing experiments that you know so much more about than I do, and even you know, masses of goods that came to thousands of pounds that were shipped out even by airplane. It's kind of extraordinary. But of course, there was a lot by boat as well. Some things were also shipped over or by flown to the ports and were taken by boat across. Now, another horrible American betrayal is that some of those boats were also put into service to carry prisoners to the Gulag during the war. Some of them were boats made in America. We called them Liberty ships, and they were, again, part of our war effort. And supposedly, there are people who believe, and there are people who have attested to this, that there were American servicemen carried on those boats to the Gulag as well.
Get out of here. I mean, this,
well, it's a horrible thing.
You mentioned that on C-SPAN not only Roosevelt but also Eisenhower was aware that we had American POWs left behind, not in German POW camps, but in Soviet POW camps.
Yes. Yes. This is, again, something that the evidence points to. This is evidence that actually was amassed by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on the minority side back around 1990. And they put together a really amazing report that people can read for themselves. I've got the footnote. You can find it online, the entire report. And I've used that report as well as other sources that had confirming information or additional information, different memoirs and so on, that paints a truly, I mean, this is sort of the ultimate betrayal. In fact, it is my ultimate betrayal. Each chapter at a certain point is a different level of betrayal, but there's something about the betrayal of thousands of American soldiers by the government that is, you know, the cruelest cut of all. Essentially, what you had at the end of the war was a completely disintegrating Germany, of course, and the prisoner of war camps were similarly falling apart as the Germans moved west away from the Russians. They were desperate, of course, always to surrender to Americans and British rather than to the Russians, but they were fleeing to the west, and very often they would leave the prisoners behind, and the Soviets would overrun the camps. And at the point you were a prisoner of the Soviets, it was no better and indeed ended up being worse than being a prisoner of the Germans. There were thousands of them wandering around trying to find help. Many of them were sick, wounded, and we had negotiators in Moscow working very hard to set up all manner of insertion teams, arrange for American and British planes to come in, pick them up, get them medical help, and so on, of course. But the Russians would not permit this, and we allowed the Russians not to permit this. And the cable exchange between Roosevelt and Stalin, which, again, more archival material that was not available until very recent years, is just a disgusting thing to read. His impotence, his ineffectiveness. You had, on the other hand, our, at that time, ambassador to Russia, Averell Harriman, trying to negotiate his best, getting very frustrated. He had been a Hopkins hire originally, but at this point, he, at least for a period, he was extremely, at least in comparison, he was very strong-minded about trying to make the right deal for our American prisoners, but then he, too, abandoned it. You had the military, the generals, also involved. And there's a description in the cable flow. Again, it's really nothing more than the facts. At the end of May of 1945, after victory in Europe, there's a meeting between the Americans and the Russians. And the chief negotiator was, a General Barker. He's negotiating and realizing, and he writes this in the cable, that at a certain point he realizes they're not coming home anytime soon. And they may be used as bargaining chips or something, but you're reading this cable flow and you're thinking, they're not coming home. Now, meanwhile, you had the Americans negotiating and keeping track and getting records and figuring out. The estimates at the end of May were about 15,000 was one estimate out of Moscow, and then Eisenhower's Surgeon General estimated about 20. Maybe the other one. I can't remember it's the right way. But anyway, you had the two authorities at the point of the end of May of 1945 saying 15,000 to 20,000 Americans. The British estimates were more like 30,000 Commonwealth soldiers. At the end of May, about May 31st, you have another flow of cables, and you all of a sudden have an announcement from 48 hours, 24 hours after this assessment is made by Eisenhower that there are no more prisoners except for stragglers. And then right after that, you have the Undersecretary of War, Robert Patterson, declaring in Washington to the New York Times, everyone who's missing in action that we've been carrying is missing in action. We're changing to killed in action. We don't have any reason to think they're anybody that we've been carrying as possibly alive is alive. End of story.
And they knew. And they knew that all those sons, all those fathers were still alive.
Yes, they did. And the thing of it is, Brooks, is that over time, stories would come out. People who were repatriated, you know, the Soviets had, under the terms of Yalta that we agreed to, they had millions of German slaves for some number of years. This was part of war reparations. Those Germans would come out, or Japanese prisoners would come out, and they would tell our intelligence people. There's a series of files called the Ringer files. They would tell, when they were debriefed, they would tell of Americans that they saw, officers, flyers, young men from Virginia. I mean, they would talk about people they'd seen in the different camps, uranium mines, just horrendous. Horrendous stories that were top secret, were not, of course, brought out. And when this report came out, this Senate report in around 1990, one of the items that they brought to light was that there was, I believe, a Major Thompson was one of the men discussed in these files after the war, 10, 15 years after the war. And his daughter came forward, and she was interviewed, I think it was by the Washington Times, and she said, how could it be that my father was alive and well in the 1950s and the United States government never told us? We'd been told he was killed in action.
Yeah, and there was no guesswork about it. They knew, and they probably knew pretty much the identities of most of those 15 to 20,000 Americans that were left behind. And, you know, we find it so amazing, so shocking that our current administration would leave an ambassador behind in Benghazi to die. But the strange thing about that is that there were survivors. There were survivors on the ground in Benghazi, and they were removed from there and taken to hospitals in the United States and have supposedly been there for the last 8 months, and no one has been able to speak to them except appointees of the president.
That's true. That's true. I know that for a fact is true. It's this notion of elites, our political leaders, and again, you know, we're not even talking about one party versus the other. Eisenhower's a Republican, Truman was Democrat, Roosevelt, of course. And later on, as the administrations were undoubtedly aware of various prisoner bodies, whether it was Korea, later in Vietnam, which amazingly is the war that is the most famous for this myth, this thought, this reality, we don't even really know, you know, in terms of the public perception of prisoners left behind. And that would be the war that actually left the fewest number behind. It's something
Vietnam.
In Vietnam, right. If you've got
15,000 to 20,000
Americans in World War II and about 8,000 believed to be left behind in Korea, a couple thousand during the whole Cold War, and then I think the estimate is around 1,000 to 2,000 after Vietnam. But that was the one that came closest to public perception. And I was so struck when Boris Yeltsin, I looked back at some transcript between Boris Yeltsin and the first President Bush. Boris Yeltsin, when he became president of that toxic dump known as the former Soviet Union, seemed to be reacting in a fairly human way, you know, to try to understand what had happened and to try to bring it to, bring it to book, try to bring out what he could. And he actually made statements, made no uncertain terms, statements that he believed Americans had, soldiers had been in the gulag and that he was trying to figure it out. Well, George Bush, the father, I mean, he might as well have shoved a shoe in Boris Yeltsin's mouth at their little press conference when Yeltsin drops this on the press corps. He just shuts the whole thing down. The whole mission to understand what was in the gulag in terms of Americans was always a dog and pony show. And when we finally got a report around, 2005 or 6, maybe even 2007 from this commission, that yes, you have an admission from the U.S. government, yes, there were soldiers kept, American soldiers, in the gulag. And the estimate was, you know, the man said, well, I'm comfortable saying, you know, I don't know, some hundreds, which I think was not really very accurate, but, you know, you finally get this admission that, yes, they were there, and the government does nothing. There's never any sense of reckoning. You don't have the President of the United States, you know, run up that POW MIA flag one day and say, people, we found this out. I mean, it's like everything just drifts on. And, again, you know, this theme of American betrayal, it is the worst betrayal.
Well, it is, and so let's go back to the beginning of the interview when we're saying that this was not perpetrated by Americans inside America. This was perpetrated by an occupied Washington, D.C. that had hundreds, if not thousands, of Soviet agents working at all kinds of levels in almost every agency, dealing with money, dealing with industrial secrets, dealing with military and weapons secrets. We've already said that the Nagasaki and Hiroshima bombs were no surprise to the Germans. And when it blew up in 1949 and the investigation began, who did they pin it on? The Rosenbergs, who were summarily shot.
Right, right. It's and that committee, by the way, was called... Oh, I lost the name again. I'll find it again. I thought I brought it up for you.
The point I'm trying to make is if these same activities are going on today, some 50 years later, have all these Soviet agents left, or are they still and generationally embedded now in our government? And this is why we are seeing shenanigans where we are taking stolen weapons from Libya and piping them into Syria so that we can keep on fighting the old Soviet war.
Well, you know, it's interesting you should mention that, because one of the things that becomes very clear, and I first found this out from Stanton Evans' amazing book, Blacklisted by History, which is a new look at Joe McCarthy and shows that he was right. Documents show that he was right. One of the things that Stan Evans found, and I consider him a mentor of mine, he was very generous with me with his time when I had questions for him when I was embarking on this book. He discovered when he was trying to reassemble a real archive of documents that would give him a way to build the life and times of Joe McCarthy, those documents are gone. Our National Archive is like Swiss cheese.
Really?
Documents, yes, it is absolutely chilling. Someone always seemed to be ahead of Stanton Evans when he was looking for these archival documents. I'm talking about things like in committee investigations that, you know, lists of what they used to call subversives, documents, even the newspapers of the Wheeling, West Virginia newspaper that covered Joe McCarthy's initial, his maiden anti-communist speech in 1950. The newspaper microfilm for that particular span of time is the only newspaper microfilm in the archives of the West Virginia newspaper that are missing. It's just too weird. Everywhere you go, you find that a document is not where it's supposed to be. I found it myself, going back to George Earle, the man who was trying to parley with the anti-Nazi Germans. He had set up before he left, he was Roosevelt's special emissary, and I found a letter, not where it was supposed to be, where Earl had written to Hopkins saying, basically, Harry, he liked Harry quite a lot. He said, Harry, I like the way you think. I want you to be my conduit to the big boss because, you know, you'll know what's important to show him, basically. This was just as Earl left for his foray in 1943, which is when he was making contact with these German groups. Well, the file where Earl's letters back home to to Hopkins in this period where he was having contact with the Germans, it's empty. There aren't any letters in there. I went there. I see it listed in the library listings, and I'm so excited. I go and I get the archivist to pull the files. I'm sitting there. I open up the magic file. There's nothing there. And there's a little card, a typed little note that says that these letters had been removed. The folder contents were removed. It says, previous correspondence to and from Lieutenant Commander George Earle was packed and sent to Mr. Hopkins' home November 22, 1944, for his use.
My goodness.
So I'm thinking he heated his home with it.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking, too. Yeah, it either went in the round file. They didn't have shredders in those days, so it just went into the fireplace. Wow, what an interesting hour. Will you stay another?
Sure, why not?
Well, I'm having fun. I hope you are, too.
Yes, I am.
Really amazing stuff. Thank you so much. All right, let's take a quick break again, get something cold to drink. We'll be back as we're going to go into how does this really affect modern times? What's really going on here? What is the real importance and power of great, I'm going to call it historical investigative journalism? What is the value of it? We're going to find out in our next hour. Don't go away. More X Squared Radio and Diana West after this.
to touch. I told the truth. I didn't come to fool you.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, coming to you live from just outside of Charlotte. My guest tonight is Diana West. Her book is American Betrayal. And if you have ever taken history in school and thought, oh, gee, what am I going to do? Learning all these dates and these names, what good is it? How can it ever benefit me? I can't wait to get out of this class. My history class was taught by an amazing wrestling teacher in high school, very inspirational. He used to just sit on a stool in front of the class and tell us story after story from history. It was like being there. So if you have a gifted teacher, it can be amazing. And tonight, because we have the amazing investigative work and really incredible speaking mannerisms of Diana West, describing as she follows the trail of this book as she's doing the research for it, it is literally one heartbreak after another as she discovers what really went on. Not what you learned in the press. Certainly not what you heard in your history books. This is the real history. And the question is, now that you are informed, now that you are empowered with this information, where do we go from here? What is the value of this information, you as Americans, as really world citizens, because this is a global radio program tonight. We're being listened to live in New Zealand, in Wales, in India, all over the United States, Canada, and even South America, right at this very moment. And people are hearing what's going on behind the curtain, why things ended up the way they did, and discoveries that we never knew, things that just this last Memorial Day weekend, I'm watching Diana West being interviewed on C-SPAN, and I'm in sort of a Memorial Day mood. I'm a veteran myself, come from a family of veterans, and I'm learning about literally the betrayal of our own government from inside our own government, layers and layers and layers of spies and agents and sources of misinformation to keep us off balance. But we're not ignorant. The presidents were not ignorant. Senate committee chairmen were not ignorant. But there were individuals who thought America meant more than that. There were individuals that came forth, truth tellers, she calls them. And one of those may or may not be a truth teller, but it was definitely one of the loudest voices, and I heard his name mentioned just the other day on television, was Joe McCarthy. Of course, yeah. It was used as an anachronism. It was a McCarthyism, and these were calls against the congressional committees, and there are multiple of them now, investigating things like IRS being used to attack conservative groups, Justice Department investigations of legitimate members of the mainstream press, and excoriating investigations into what happened in Benghazi, just to name a few. And I heard the term McCarthyism. So let's talk a little bit about the enigma of Joe McCarthy. What was he doing? What was he trying to tell us in those days?
Well, Joe McCarthy is, we have the truth tellers who are the great witnesses, and then we have the great investigators, of whom Joe McCarthy was certainly the leading figure. There were others. There were other senators. There were other congressmen, representatives. They were from both parties. You had Senator Pat McCarran, for example, in the Senate, a Democrat. You had Joe McCarthy, a Republican. You had Martin Dies in the Congress, who opened up the House Committee on Un-American Activities in 1938 to investigate Nazism, fascism, Japanese Shintoism, and communism. And what did Roosevelt do? They had been political allies up to this point. Roosevelt tried to get him to stop investigating communism. When we get up to about 1950, when Joe McCarthy, I have this in the book, it's kind of one of the stunning little moments that are kind of pass in history. Martin Dies, in his memoir, he wrote a memoir in the 60s called Martin Dies' Story. And in that memoir, he discusses being at dinner at an old, vanished, venerable restaurant in Washington named Harvey's on Connecticut Avenue downtown. And Joe McCarthy stopped by his table with his fiancée at the time, the woman he would marry, one of his aides, actually, a beautiful aide that he would marry in a couple of years. But they stopped by Martin Dies' table, and Joe McCarthy actually says to Martin Dies, he says, "You know, Martin, I'm thinking of holding some investigations into communism." And he asked for some advice. And I always just think, you know, did lightning strike? Did the earth open up? I mean, what happened at this very moment? It just seems like such a kind of improbable, dramatic, but understated kind of little moment in history. Martin Dies went on to tell Joe McCarthy to expect the worst, to expect to be smeared, to be on the lookout for people trying to set him up, and so on, and gave him very good advice, because what I learned again in Stanton Evans' book, Blacklisted by History, everything that happened to Joe McCarthy had happened first to Martin Dies. But after the war, this is, you know, 12 years later from when Martin Dies opened shop and did very important work in identifying penetration in the years coming up to the war in particular. After the war, something different was going on in Washington. The elites, the White House, whether it was Truman, who followed Roosevelt, or Eisenhower, who followed Truman, all of a sudden, they had secrets to hide. They weren't interested in unmasking the infiltration because it reflected badly on the power structure, whether it was Truman worrying about election year, or Eisenhower, at a certain point, worrying about whatever he was compromised by, including when we were talking about the POW issue and other matters. The impulse of our government at this point becomes suppression of the truth. That's why I call these people the truth tellers. And on the other hand, you have the investigators like McCarthy, who essentially were functioning very much like, you know, that sort of metaphor that people use with the blind monks trying to feel and describe an elephant. What they were looking at, what they were trying to uncover, what they were trying to bring sunshine to, I mean, we're talking about forces of sunshine, of openness, was a deep, dark secret that the powers that be were doing everything possible to hide. So you had conspiracy happening and conspirators trying to suppress the facts versus the great anti-communists who were trying to bring it into the open. And this is why I believe that the dynamic was so difficult for McCarthy, and why indeed, because he was so popular with the people of this country, why he had to be destroyed, why he had to bear everything he had to bear. And indeed, he was 48 years old, 49, 48 when he died. I mean, this killed him.
Yeah,
but,
just they wore him down until his heart broke.
Yeah, I really think that's true. And indeed, with all this evidence in recent years that has come out, that has identified spy after spy. And these were Americans. You know, we call it Soviet-occupied Washington, but of course these were American traitors. When you start looking at these lists and you realize that what McCarthy, you know, as the sort of the symbolic leader of the investigators was doing, he was trying to save America. He was trying to say, I go even farther. In some sense, these people, the Whitaker Chambers, one of the great witnesses, Joe McCarthy, one of the great investigators, what they were looking for, in a sense, was a way to save reality, a way to save our grasp on the truth, on facts. They were trying to bring evidence forward of what was going on, whereas the elites, the pundits, the people who, you know, with publishing houses and newspapers and penthouses and White Houses, all of that, they were trying to tell a lie to the American people and change our grasp on reality. And I don't think there's any accident that at this midpoint of the 20th century is where we start seeing the rise of things like cultural relativism and moral relativism and things like non-judgmentalism. In other words, all things that are ways the human brain avoids facts. And that indeed is what undermines our society, and that's where you get the subtitle of my book, really, the Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. It's really the insertion of ideology, of ends justify the means ideology, into our institutions, because I actually argue that the recognition of the Soviet Union by Roosevelt in November 1933 was really a turning point for our republic, because it actually required our institutions, our political leadership, to lie. The whole relationship was based on a lie. The actual agreement, it's kind of amazing, Brooks, the actual agreement that finally permitted the American, or that finally determined that the U.S. would recognize Russia, Soviet Russia, four presidents before Roosevelt refused, because it was a revolutionary entity designed for our destruction. That was pretty good policy, but Roosevelt reversed it. The agreement was essentially a series of promises the Soviet Union made not to try to overthrow the American government, not to support secret cadres of agents to overthrow the American government, all of which was already underway and would only exponentially increase in the years to come. So in other words, to keep that agreement, America had to pretend that the Soviets were upholding their end of the bargain. And this, I do believe it, big lie begot big lie, and all of a sudden you start seeing double standards in American foreign policy, and indeed in society itself. And again, you start seeing a growing complicity. We talked a little bit about Katyn, where America lied for the Soviet Union. We go forward to another betrayal, the repatriation of 2 million Soviet-claimed nationals that America and Britain helped Stalin take back to the Gulag or to be shot. So you see sort of lying, complicity, participation, collusion, and then you see suppression. And I do maintain that this is why when the Soviet Union actually dissolved, you don't see a lot of euphoria in Western elites. And I think part of the reason is that we had a lot to answer for, or really they. I don't consider myself part of that Western elite. They had a lot to answer for, and it was decades of this kind of collusion.
Well, one of the other things that we did not see when the wall fell and somehow we won this economic race that ended up breaking their economy and the internal stress tore them apart, whatever it was, we did not see a major exodus of spies in Washington. They're still there. They're still operating. Now, there may not be a Soviet Union, but there is definitely an anti-American, anti-Western sentiment that is going on. We just saw some of that in Boston a few weeks ago. Now, one of my best listeners writes me and says, what are some of your own thoughts on how the modern hearings are going and reports on the mishandling of the press, IRS, Benghazi, etc. As you're watching these hearings being chaired by Issa, and you see extremely talented congressmen asking very drilling questions, getting at the truth, what do you make of the hearings that are going on today about the same kind of activities?
Well, that's a very good question. I've been particularly one of my subjects that I write about in my weekly newspaper, syndicated newspaper column, certainly, and at my website even more so, has been Benghazi. I think probably in the month of October, coming up to the election, I must have written a piece a day about Benghazi, and certainly follow it quite avidly. I have been very disappointed with the line of inquiry to date, because I feel as if it is simply chewing on the edges. The main preoccupation of the investigation to date has been on what they call security failures, as if to say having better guards would have made everything all right, or listening to the complaints about the security would have been all right. Benghazi is a very complex issue. It's multi-level. I mean, it's many, many dimensions. What is not being looked at, and what I do not believe will be looked at, and this to me is the tragedy, and actually what takes us back to a good parallel with the communist struggle. We are not looking at the ideological policy that put America in support of Al-Qaeda in Libya, that led us to a situation where the U.S. compound in Benghazi was being guarded by jihadists on the inside. I'm speaking specifically of February 17th Martyrs Brigade. February 17th Martyrs Brigade was the security force presented to us by the Libyan government. February 17th Martyrs Brigade, just so you know what it is, it commemorates a February 17th back in 2006 when Benghazi rioted against the Italian consulate in protest of the Italian minister, Roberto Calderoli, having declared solidarity with the Danish cartoonists and free speech. He had gone on Italian TV and said that the Western world has free speech and you can draw cartoons, essentially, and this is just something the Islamic world has to recognize, that we have free speech in the West. And indeed, he showed that he was wearing a T-shirt with not the Danish cartoons. It was kind of an ecumenical cartoon that depicted various religious leaders, including Muhammad, and he said, I'm keeping this shirt on until the Islamic world recognizes free speech. Well, immediately, the Friday after, Friday prayers in Benghazi, the people were ginned up so that thousands of people protested, very similarly to the way they did our compound, protested the Italian consulate. They burnt it. The Italians had to be evacuated at risk for their lives. Gaddafi's army at the time, or police, was still in force, and they fired on the crowd at a certain point, and maybe a dozen of the Benghazians were killed. Those are the martyrs. That's who's named for the people guarding our people in Benghazi. That's just the very beginning of this problem.
Wow.
Libya Shield, another militia, another jihadist militia. They fly the black flag of Al-Qaeda. Hillary Clinton gets a stray question about that, and she actually tells the Congress, well, we have to support anti-jihadists no matter what color their flag is, words to that effect. Not even getting to the point where if you fly the black flag of jihad, it's likely that you are indeed a jihad. Look at the triumph there of deconstructionism. I mean, it's really pretty profound. You had Christopher Stevens, our late ambassador. Yeah?
Well, I was going to say, the assertion that Al-Qaeda was not active, that there was, you know, that this was
a lie.
Yeah, it was absolutely all fabricated. And then everyone in the public knows this and knew it within probably 2 days of when it occurred. And that's why when Ambassador Rice hit the airwaves that Sunday, I've never actually seen that done, five Sunday shows by one person. Everybody knew it was all propaganda, and they even arrested the guy, and I think he's still in prison.
He's in jail. He's got a year-long sentence. He's serving. I maintain he's serving. He's an American in prison for having violated Islamic law against criticizing Muhammad. This was a sop to the Islamic world. But you see, what we have here is an ideological policy that actually put us on the side very openly of Al-Qaeda in Libya. We overthrew Gaddafi, who was an anti-jihadist at this point in his career, and we gave no-fly zones and support and training and weapons to people in Benghazi, where it is known the concentration of Benghazi martyrs, quote marks around martyrs and fighters who went to Iraq to fight Americans is the highest in the world. You have the militias in Libya that we supported, very close to Al-Qaeda, various hierarchies, colluding and in touch with the people who did the London underground bombings, the Madrid train bombings. This is who America supports in Libya. Indeed, this is the policy of the Arab Spring. Is Congress asking questions about this policy shift that has openly put the United States on the jihad? No. No, they're not. There was one question, line of questions came from Representative Aaron Holt of Texas when he had the three so-called whistleblowers from the State Department. And it was quite, I actually wrote a whole column up just about that because it was sort of like this window that opened on this very issue. And then I have seen no follow-up. But basically, he was asking, why did we have February 17th Martyrs Brigade? Are they jihadists? Why did we have them guarding? And indeed, it was Nordstrom who went very strongly and in no uncertain terms say, this is what we do everywhere. We do it in Saudi Arabia. We do it in Yemen. We have it in Afghanistan. This is the policy. And it was sort of like this eureka moment. But then the line of questions is over in 5 minutes, and I've seen no follow-up. Now you have the committee still chewing on the edges of, weren't you told you needed more security? I mean, it's kind of like, I think, in some ways, a giant act of misdirection on their own part. Yes, there are lapses, yes, and so on, and yet it's the policy. The policy of this administration was not to have American uniforms on the ground because it might arouse the locals to jihad. However, we insert diplomats there to try to see if they can, you know, kind of tame the tiger. It's an insane policy, and it's a grotesque policy when you think about the fact we're supporting people who just a year or two earlier were in Iraq blowing up our troops.
Right, right. It's appeasement, you know, just the same yes. kind of policy. You feed your friends to the alligator hoping it will eat you last.
Yes.
And let's do what you did in your book. Let's look at the map. Libya is not all that important. I mean, it has a lot of oil, but strategically,
oil. Yeah.
as far as taking over the Middle East, is inconsequential. What is important is that there is a center of conflict known as Syria, and Syria is the ancient, you know, seat of the prince of the Middle East. You know, it's often said, as Egypt goes, so goes the Middle East. Parenthetically, I was in Egypt, in Tahrir Square, a couple of weeks before the Arab Spring erupted. We were sitting on the wall outside the Museum of Egypt, or Museum of Cairo. And, you know, the prayer starts at 5 o'clock over the speakers, and it's kind of pleasant, you know, to hear the singing. And then the singing ends, the prayer's over. And another guy takes the microphone and he begins speaking in Arabic. And, you know, I live in the South here in North Carolina. And from time to time on AM radio on Sunday mornings, you get to hear a Southern preacher throw down some fire and brimstone. Well, that's what this began to sound like, a little bit like Arabic fire and brimstone. So I asked my guide, who's a female, and she's with our group of 11. And I said, what is he saying exactly? And she listens for a moment, and she goes, well, he's just speaking to the people, you know, about something coming up, some big event coming up. And I said, no. I know Arabic. I know enough Arabic to know what's going on, not exactly what he's saying, but it's the way that he's saying it. It sounds like he's preaching, like he's trying to rouse people up. What is he saying? And so she listened a little bit more, and then she said, I think we need to get back on the bus. We all got back on the bus and we left, and 3 days later we flew out, and 5 days later the whole Arab Spring erupted. The tension of what was going to happen was already happening over the mosques and the prayer things all over Egypt, and that's what got everybody riled up. That's what made it happen. So let's look at the map again. We have Syria as this seat of conflict, and I don't know if you've seen the pictures coming out of Syria, but you know, it looks like southern Russia during World War II. It is completely bombed out. Every street, every restaurant, every apartment is laid to waste. There is nothing, not a blade of grass, not an electric light, nothing left. It is amazing how devastated that place is. But Libya has 20,000 rockets, grenades, shoulder-fired missiles, the latest and best stuff because Gaddafi's wealthy. It's sitting there in Libya, all free contraband. And it is now becoming widely known that Stevens was making a deal with Turkey to move those weapons through Turkey into Syria to be used by Al-Qaeda. And that's right. Why everyone in the compound was either killed or is in sequestration right now.
I'd like the Congress to, you know, push that. I mean, Stevens, and I'm a big fan of, I read a lot of WikiLeaks. And frankly, one of the things I learned in doing this this book was I would like to see WikiLeaks. I would like to see a lot. I would like to see our archives just opened up. There is just much in our archives that there's no reason for secrecy except to spare the U.S. government embarrassment, and that's not a reason for secrets when you know you're supposed to be a democratic republic. But I went through quite a lot of cables that Christopher Stevens wrote through the years. And he was of the mind, I became clear, convinced, that he could use these Al-Qaeda people, he could use these jihadists late of either Afghanistan or, you know, or literally from Guantanamo that were repatriated to Libya early on, even still during the Bush years. And there's a strange sympathy that comes through his cables for them, for these fighters. And you see the wheels turning and his realization that if we only got rid of Gaddafi, they would be happy. They would like us. You almost get the feeling. I feel that he was either sympathetic to them or he was played by them. But he was certainly talking nonsense in terms of failing to appreciate the doctrinal, the Islamic, the cultural cult of jihad in these societies. And this is actually another kind of betrayal in the sense that our government, since 9/11, has made it an official policy to ignore Islam as an enemy threat doctrine. What I found in my research was that this was identical to what was going on during World War II when communism was similarly whitewashed. It's really kind of an amazing thing. There were no anti-communist books published during World War II. There was just a moratorium on anything critical. Anything that was not positive was thrown out, ostracized, even to the point of, this was really amazing, Trotsky's biography of Stalin, which was going to come out with Harper Publishers in 1941. The review copies were out. Trotsky, of course, had been murdered by Stalin while he was finishing the book. And in fact, I read and found out that blood from the ice pick driven into his head actually had spattered on his manuscript, and they had to put the thing back together with blood on it. This book was put together, it was coming out, and when we became official allies, Cass Canfield, the publisher of Harper at the time, very famous New York publisher, wrote letters to reviewers and asked them to return the review copies and not mention the book. This is what was going on, the whitewashing of communism. Similarly, actually worse, in our time, we have a whitewash of Islam to a point where our security agencies are forbidden to train, to understand jihad, to have educational materials that I think would even exclude the Quran. The problem, the worst, the place where we are actually at a greater disadvantage is in the old days, you had an anti-communist FBI. You had Hoover was the, you know, super anti-communist of the age. He understood it. He was a student of it. His agency was following it. In our time under William Mueller, you have a de-Islamized FBI. You have an FBI structure where Islam is verboten. And so in a sense, we are actually at a greater disadvantage, more willfully blind even than we were in the 1940s.
Wow. Wow. So when we had this agent drain or an agent maybe change hands inside all of the agencies of the United States after the Cold War was over and hundreds, perhaps thousands of agents that were inside of Washington, D.C. didn't just sell their homes and move away. Maybe they just went back to normal lives. It's hard to tell. But any of you that have been to Detroit or been to the Beltway of, in Atlanta or Houston or any of these places will notice that there are a lot of Islamists everywhere, and they're not coming in broke. They're coming in and they're buying up properties, whole city blocks, and they're moving in, and they are supplying hundreds of millions, maybe even billions of dollars to startup companies in the United States, ostensibly to create jobs, but they're in key industries. And anybody wonder why Iran was able to fly an RQ-170 stealth drone and land it at their own airport just by taking over the joystick and flying it home? People, let's put the dots together here.
Right.
This is really, really powerful stuff. And this book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character, is the can opener that is opening the can of worms that makes up our, what do you call it, Swiss cheese government that we're seeing right now.
It is. It is. I mean, I actually, you know, particularly since 9/11, I'm a journalist. I write this column. I've been chronicling the Islamization of the West ever since 9/11. And I actually set out, when I was trying to do my research under the title The Hollow Center, I was actually trying to understand how it could be that you could mine and study all of these facts about jihad, about Islam, about the experience of Jews and Christians living under various Islamic regimes over centuries, over continents. There's a commonality here, and that is the evaporation of religious liberty, freedom of conscience, equal protection under the law. These are the things that disappear under Islamic law, just no way around it. I was trying to understand how it could be that you could sort of present this evidence and nothing would happen, in the sense, in what I mean by that is no one would draw a conclusion, in public anyway, that Islam was anything other than a religion of peace. 9/11 happens, the government says Islam is a religion of peace. In the public square, all people do is rearrange the facts to support this preposterous notion, this propaganda. So I was trying to figure out, do we have historical precedent for this? Is there a period of time where this kind of completely anti-logical process took hold? This is when I started going back in time and realizing there's so many commonalities between our period and the period of the communist struggle, which does include World War II, unbeknownst to Americans who go through the public and private school system, for that matter. Stalin was always at war with the United States. We thought he was our ally, but there was an intelligence war going on, and we had different war goals. This is why, you know, Brooks, it sounds extremely overbearing to say so, but the research that comes out of the intelligence archives that confirms all of this, this intelligence war that I try to reweave into our general history in this book, American Betrayal, it actually invalidates the tons of history books that have been written that have not taken into account this intelligence war being waged by the Soviet Union the whole time, because all of these books, these conventional stories, assume that we all had the same war goals and that, you know, everything was hunky-dory until after the war. And when you actually learn that there was a vicious war underway waged by Stalin against us from the start, well, even before the start of the war, but certainly during the war, everything looks different. And that is, you know, again, where you end up with this notion of betrayal. But the parallels with today, the mindset, the denial, what happens to truth tellers, you try to tell the truth about Islam, you lose your job in the FBI or the Pentagon.
Sure.
In the past, you had anti-communist officials purged. It's strange. The State Department used to have anti-communist officials. The foreign minister of the Soviet Union, Litvinov, comes to the American government in 1943 with a list of anti-communist American officials in the State Department and asks that they be purged. Well, they were. They were gone. One went to Iraq, one went to Turkey, one went to Canada. The libraries were broken up. The files were dispersed. Some of these men actually hung on to some of the files, but they were supposed to be destroyed. You had this all going on. Similarly, today, you had Muslim groups going to John Brennan, at the time President Obama's security advisor, back in fall of 2011. He presents a similar kind of list of trainers considered anti-Islamic, training materials they wanted purged. What do you know? It was done.
Yeah, they're all gone.
The parallel is uncanny.
So we're not learning from history, but maybe the listeners tonight's program and the readers of your book will do just that. Now, let me ask you another question, because this book sounds like it would be a hell of a screenplay.
Mm.
Is anyone from Hollywood talking to you about a screenplay, and are you looking for a screenwriter?
Well, funny you should ask. Someone from Hollywood is talking to me, but I probably can't say more than that.
That's all. That's good enough.
I've
not written any screenplays, but it is not easy to do. And
right.
One of the things that we do with film, Hollywood in this country, is we make rather powerful political statements. And usually, and this goes all the way back to World War I, you know, when movies were just, you know, being popularized, and certainly in World War II because it was an escape from reality. And even in books, we did political satire, we did political exposé, but now it has gone the other way. It's almost as though Hollywood is the central propaganda outlet for the world. And I'm talking about everything from brain-eating aliens to bungling, stupid Arabs, you know, trying to hijack a Harrier jet with Arnold Schwarzenegger and Roseanne Barr's husband, you know, battling them.
Right.
Nothing could be further from the truth. We're talking about billions of dollars of Saudi money being poured, not trickled, poured into our country right now, actually for about the last 10 years. And the results are showing up in almost every major city in the country, from Montana to Florida, all over D.C. You want to know what the number one selling cars inside the Beltway are? Lamborghini, Maserati, Ferrari, number one dealerships in the nation. Those aren't politicians buying those. Those are lobbyists buying those.
Well, it's true. I mean, the power of mass media is enormous, of course. It was certainly manipulated during World War II for the war effort. But in terms of the communist infiltration, you know, we usually focus on, this communist screenwriter got a little Marxist propaganda into a script. That actually is not what they really were successful at. What they did, and they bragged about it, Dalton Trumbo, the most talented, to be sure, of the Hollywood Ten, the unfriendly communist witnesses, was a screenwriter, and he bragged in 1946 that what they had managed to do was keep the great anti-communist novels and books from being made into movies. They had communists in the script writing, the script vetting machinery. They had communists at the government sort of censorship boards. They had communists certainly in the writers' colony. It was an intensive movement to hide communist reality, and so therefore you never saw a movie of Darkness at Noon, for example, Arthur Kessler's great book, great novel. You never saw Red Army atrocities. If you think about all the movies made and you think back of 100 million people killed by communism in the 20th century, it is amazing to realize that you have very likely never seen a communist army committing atrocities, whereas you have seen probably more Nazi atrocities on the screen because of all the years that have gone by than actually could have been, you know, incidents during that 12-year span of the Reich. We have Nazi villains to this day, and we still don't have communist villains in movies. It's an amazing accomplishment of the propaganda machine. Yeah. I can think of only one movie, a really great movie, Night Without Armor, a movie with Marlene Dietrich and Robert Donat, where you actually see Red Army, you know, mowing down people. But it's the only one I can think of. That's what they accomplished, the whitewash of that regime.
Well, we had Red Dawn come out in the 80s, and
yeah, that's
where
true.
Russia was attacking the United States. But even then...
But it was in the future, too.
Yeah, and the main the main communists in the movies were actually Cubans, not Russians.
Right.
And then you had Red Dawn 2 come out. It got funded, it got scripted, it got casted, and it was partially shot. But China did not want portrayed in the movie. And so China came and asserted their money and had all of the flags and emblems changed in the movie digitally to North Korean.
Right. I remember that. That's extraordinary. The first movie that ever, to my knowledge, ever actually treated the experience of communism in Eastern Europe was The Lives of Others, which was made by a young German filmmaker. You never had that done. You had no grown-up assessment, no grown-up stories about this incredible dramas, whether it was Cubans trying to flee Cuba, whether it was people trying to get out from the Iron Curtain. It's as if it didn't exist in our popular consciousness, which I write about quite a lot, about this shaping of the public consciousness so that there's no context. When you finally have, you know, a Solzhenitsyn come out and talk about his experience, and no one could not look at the riveting Solzhenitsyn, it sounded kind of crazy to people who hadn't been prepared all along the way with the truth.
Exactly.
And I think the same is going on with Islam.
And I'm glad you brought up the word grown up, because there was a book that was written, highly popularized, and made into several movies that was a satire on the economic takeover of the United States and the industrial and farming and political landscape. And it was The Wizard of Oz. It was L. Frank Baum's political satire.
Yeah.
And nobody caught it. And nobody remembers, because they don't read the book, they just watch the movies, that Dorothy's slippers were not ruby. They were silver. She's supposed to click her heels, her silver heels together three times in order to go home. In other words, put us back on the silver standard.
Yeah.
Had nothing to do with rubies.
Right. Amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, that's very, very cool. Very cool observations. And I think media is, unfortunately, how most people learn their history. Forget about the kids. Let's watch the movie.
Well, it's true. And you know, I mean, again, you know, I kept feeling personally betrayed by this material as I was sitting in my study, usually in the dark by myself, looking at all of this. But you know, you realize how robbed we are as a people, as a culture. We don't have the lore. We don't have the tradition. We don't have the stories. We don't have the stories. And I was so struck. Solzhenitsyn wrote at a certain point about how he doesn't consider the censored literature of the Soviet period to be literature because it's not telling the truth. It doesn't tell the full story.
Oh, right.
And when I think about his words and I think, my gosh, we are in the same predicament. We don't have our lore either. Our stories, maybe they're self-censored, but they are just as empty. They are just as devoid of the full story as even a gulag nation like the Soviet Union. And I constantly wonder, you know, what is this power over a free people? We don't have police knocking at the door, at least not yet. We don't have a gulag over these years putting people away who step out of line in journalism or media, writing and so on, movies. What is this power? And you realize it is a subversion of the mind, and it's a soft totalitarian mindset.
Yeah, it's not so soft if you talk to David Rosen. He's
right, exactly.
For his life right now.
Right.
Absolutely amazing. The book is American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can get it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, everywhere where fine books are sold. I'm sure it's going up the charts on the New York Times list as well. Diana West has been
my
guest. Is there anything that you would like to add that you never get to add in any other interviews? Because we've certainly gone places in this interview, just because we like to talk about this subject here. Is there anything you would like to add in the last 10 minutes?
Well, I know it's a lot for people to digest, and it's always funny. I mean, you've given me, you know, thank you for this luxury of time to actually try to develop some of this, but imagine when you're actually trying to rewrite 20th century history in, you know, a 10-minute radio spot. It's very shocking to people when they first hear it. Again, I spent 4 years writing this book, and it's about 400 pages. I've got almost 1,000 footnotes. Because it is such a hair-raising story. My editor was kind of funny. You know, with book publishing the way it is, there are certain cost-cutting measures taken. Some books are actually putting footnotes online to save paper and so on. And my editor said, no way, we have to have all the footnotes in your book.
They do make
no one's going to believe this. But I guess I would just hope that people, you know, come into this with an open mind and kind of just sit back and try to allow all the predispositions, all the conditioning that we are all subject to relax a little and again, try to follow the logic where it leads. We are logical human beings, and I just feel that we have been conditioned to a point of, well, liberty is very hard to hold if we are not cognizant of what is going on, and I guess that is the bottom line of this book and the message. Don't believe everything you hear. Read it for yourself. Instead,
especially with this recent Memorial Day, freedom isn't free, and
right.
You know, from time to time we have to fight for it. But literally, we would not ever have to put a uniform on and march over anyone's beach anywhere if we would just be true. If we would just tell the truth and be true with your people, you would never have to do that.
Yeah, and I would just hope that Americans at a certain point realize that, you know, they have the power. I feel like Congress has the power. I feel like not going with the silver shoes, but just in terms of the old-fashioned ruby slippers or the new-fashioned ruby slippers, Congress has the power. If they just simply click their heels together, they have subpoena power, they have select committee power, they have the power to get affidavits to make the record true. And, you know, I fear that they don't have the real political courage that it takes.
Yeah, they don't have the resolve. But, you know, keep in mind that it is illegal for Congress to talk directly with the agencies. They have to haul them into some committee meeting before they can get anything resolved. And all they have to do is say, I don't know. And that's
right.
The end of all these agencies, departments, bureaus, and administrations have the ability to write regulations that have the force of law. And you are not represented in any of those agencies. So you can be taxed, fined, jailed, silenced, have all your stuff confiscated, and you have no representation in that government.
Yeah, it's amazing. You know, it's something's really wrong. You just hope that Americans care enough to set things right. I guess that's really one of the question marks we have. We don't know if enough Americans care to put things right.
Well, let's hope that they do. One thing is for sure, one author does, and I am so grateful that you wrote this book.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure talking to you about it, and it's kind of, you know, it's a relief after all these years of being alone with this material to share it, I have to tell you.
You have friends here at X Squared Radio. This is the whole idea behind X Squared is that it's a mathematical function into which any number can be placed. It will come out positive. So we're not trying to take cheap shots at the government or tear down anybody. What we're trying to do is empower you as listeners and readers so that you can help us stay free and help us avoid making the mistakes of the past. Now we see the mistakes and the secrecy and espionage and subterfuge that went on during the Cold War, and we're watching exactly the same thing go on with this, I'm going to call it a ghost war, because we really don't have soldiers fighting anybody. It's just an ideological war, exactly as Diana has said.
Yes, well, we still have soldiers in Afghanistan, and we still have soldiers paying the price in hospitals where they will be in and out for the rest of their lives. These are our forgotten soldiers today. And I guess, you know, the thing that's probably most important notion to revive, I think, in Americans is notions of accountability, you know, holding generals accountable. You know, General Petraeus, we find out, is now going to some fancy Wall Street firm. After his fall from grace, I was put in mind of the famous British cabinet minister, Profumo, who in the 60s was involved in a terrible affair with a woman named Keeler, who was also involved with the Soviets, and it brought the government down, this affair. And Profumo, after resigning in disgrace, as Petraeus resigned in disgrace, Profumo went to the east end of London, where the impoverished sections are, and cleaned toilets. He went into charity work, and he literally went into menial labor to atone. And then that's what I was thinking when I saw that General Petraeus is not atoning. He's taking a fancy Wall Street job.
I could so, and he doesn't have to testify in Benghazi. By the way, tomorrow, right, 10 o'clock Eastern time, along these same lines, make sure to watch what happens to number 10 Downey Street.
Oh, what's going on there?
What you just said, an affair that's going to take a government down.
Oh, okay. Stay tuned.
Stay tuned. We get all the hottest stuff right here. Thank you so much for coming on X Squared Radio. I had a wonderful time. I enjoyed the book, and I enjoy you immensely.
Well, thank you. I hope to come back sometime.
Absolutely. Open invitation. As you're doing your investigations, if anything comes up emergency, you have an open mic here anytime.
Great. Thank you so much, Brooks.
Thank you very much. Good night.
Good night.
All right. That was Diana West. Her book is available on St. Martin's Press, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. We have about 2 minutes. I decided to close the phone lines down the last hour because we were really making good progress, and I was afraid somebody would call up and ask a question that had nothing to do with the program. I hope that you enjoyed it. One little piece of news. There is a potential pandemic out there working. Two respiratory viruses in different parts of the world have captured the attention of global health officials, a novel coronavirus in the Middle East and a new bird flu spreading in China. Both of these nations send a lot of people to this country. If you're traveling by airplane, this is a virus. So if it wouldn't be socially uncouth to wear a mask. They're packing people in these planes, no open seats. You're going to be stuck in an aluminum can at 39,000 feet with somebody that's got this H7N9 virus. It's already caused 32 deaths out of 131 known cases. It's already in the United States, in Houston, and also on the East Coast. So watch out. It can be spread from human to human. So be careful out there. We'll see you next week right here on X Squared Radio. We've got about 30 seconds left. I guess I have time for one quick update or one quick note. The Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference is coming up in October, on October 10th in Boulder, Colorado. You can access the registration in a couple of weeks. It's right there at X Squared Radio, x2-radio.com. Make sure to click on the link in the middle of the site. Go there, become familiar with it. There's going to be a lot of firsts there. The new trailer for Atlas Shrugged 3 is going to be premiered there. There's going to be electric vehicles there. There's going to be breakthrough energy, like things you have never seen before. Come, be fascinated, have your mind opened, and by all means, stay informed. Look for the good in others and help it to grow a little bit every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. We'll see you next week right here on X Squared Radio.